We could talk about just how weird St. Patrick's Day is for a second, but is that going to date the episode?
No, it doesn't have to. You can talk about a holiday when it's outside of that holiday.
Okay.
Is there a St. Patrick?
Yeah. Yeah. And he was a Catholic. He wasn't a...
Irish?
Yeah.
Isn't there Irish Catholic?
He came from England and brought...
Oh, okay. Catholicism.
The word that I can't say. To Ireland and basically like drove
Catholicology.
I don't know why it's religiology. So tough, man. But yeah, he was just a fucking, when they say that he drove the snakes out of England,
yeah,
it was him trying to drive paganism out of England. That's like the general.
Do you feel like it's one of those things that was forced? Cause like, so the United Kingdom is Britain, Wales, Scotland.
Is it Britain anymore though?
United Kingdom. Well, no, because the United Kingdom is the whole thing, right?
But, yeah, but didn't England, like, secede? I guess England and Great Britain are two different things, huh?
I don't know. They? So I know it's England, Wales, and Scotland, but then the whole thing is that...
Oh, maybe they seceded from the EU?
That's probably what you're thinking.
Yeah. Their politics make no sense.
No, but I remember the big thing being, like, Ireland was... Like, we're our own thing, but then isn't, like, the United Kingdom like, no, you're part of us. And they're like, no, we're anything. Like, we'll see.
As odd as the answer is to that, I think I remember that Northern Ireland is a part of the United Kingdom and not Southern Ireland.
There's something to do with that, yeah.
You had the IRA back in, like, the 80s and 90s popping off over there.
I remember that was a big premise for Sons of Anarchy.
Was it?
Yeah, they got their weapons from the IRA. Initially, they got their weapons when they were running guns. That was their connection.
What the
was
fuck
like
were
in
a
Belfast.
Bunch of bikers doing to a bunch of Irish people?
Because that's where. So the whole thing with Sons of Anarchy is Jax Teller's dad went over and spent some time in Ireland, and there's a chapter in Belfast, and then that connection is how the Sons of Anarchy in the United States in California Redwood, or what's it called, Charming, is where they're at. It's in the Redwood area, something like that. That's how they got into gun running, is they would get arms through the IRA and then sell those.
I don't know if I've ever seen an Irish person on a motorcycle. I don't think they're built for them.
I still think they probably ride them over there.
Like, over there, maybe.
Do you identify just because you've never seen a redheaded person with a fucking four-leaf clover tucked into their jacket riding a motor? Is that how you're making the generalization?
That was a redhead. I just, their skin's too pale. It just seems like it would be a real tough deal. I don't really remember. Oh, yeah. So, that's all St. Patrick's deal. He came down from England. He started to spread Catholicism.
Did he come down? See, this is one of the things that's confusing. When you consider it down. So, if you're talking about, let's just say, northern United States down to south. Do you consider that down?
Like, yeah, it's
we're
just
coming
going
down
south.
To Arizona. Yeah, that's
I,
kind of
I
what
think
I'm saying.
England is above Ireland, right?
Yeah, but we discussed this in the fact that when we were talking about the dam collapses and all that stuff, or no, the Salton Sea, is that it's confusing because when you look at something, it's, you know, north to south, but then you have rivers that are running that can run south to north because
that's
of the topography.
Though.
That's what I'm saying. But so then, do you consider that?
He traveled south down the globe. Unless you're on the other side of the equator, then south is north.
Okay. I think it's a lateral move. I think he chased the snakes laterally.
Over to, yeah.
Did he chase them to Ireland? Is that what the whole thing was?
No, he chased them out of Ireland. And okay. It's like a myth because apparently, I don't know how.
What do you mean you're chasing? Like, you're, yeah. Is this a fucking Pied Piper situation that he's like, loo, 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 and they're all just running away from him?
They somehow didn't have snakes in Ireland back when he lived. Like, snakes hadn't made it, I guess, like, in the land
there's
bridge
no snakes,
or Pangaea.
There's no snakes in Hawaii.
Yeah, I don't get that. How is that?
You have, because they can't get across that area. You have to. They would have to be brought there.
Yeah, but Hawaii also shot up out of the ground, right?
Like, eventually,
it came
at
from
some
earthquakes.
Point.
Well, I mean, volcanoes.
Yeah.
This is going to sound bad if I'm wrong about a lot of this, but.
I would assume Ireland might have some. I don't know. I don't
they
know
had
enough.
To have been a part of Pangaea. But were snakes around then? Who the fuck knows?
Yeah.
But they weren't around when he was driving them out, but he was also pushing paganism out of the Irish culture.
Is that what they meant by snakes?
That's
then?
Exactly what they meant by snakes. Okay. Yeah, he was
snakes is a goddamn metaphor for a previously existing religion that didn't fit the narrative of what he was pushing.
We'll have to learn about it because apparently there's like druids. I don't know what druids are besides like what
druids
you see
are
in movies
like monks.
Or wrestling. Oh, is it?
I think druids are kind of like what you would consider like in other cultures, like monks to be. There's some type of like, but maybe it's monks are for, what do you normally think of Buddhism when you think of monks? Buddhist monks. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so maybe druids are like.
Are those assholes that.
Pagan monks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could be. But so, yeah, he helped to bring the Catholic Church to Ireland, and that's why he celebrated.
Yay.
It's good stuff, but it seems odd that there are so many rules with a holiday that's just centered around getting shit-faced.
Oh, yeah.
Like, at work, I had some lady be like, oh, you're not wearing green. It's like, what the fuck are we doing? We're all adults here. Mm-hmm. We don't have to wear green into the office. That's not how it
works. You fucking try to pinch
me. Yeah, like, I'm wearing red. Do you want to kiss right now and make this fucking weird? Because you bring anybody up here that says, oh, you're wearing red, you need a kiss. I'll kiss every one of those sons of bitches. But it doesn't matter as far as, like...
I'm wearing red underwear. I'll tell you where you can kiss it.
It seems odd that you have to wear green and follow all these rules to do all this stuff and eat corned beef and cabbage and all that. But then you're just like irresponsible for the night. It's like, hey, you followed all the rules of St. Patrick's Day in the day. Go get shit faced.
So there's a lot of fishy made up shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not buying this whole St. Patrick thing.
You know where there's also a lot of fishy made up shit?
Conspiracy theories usually.
Oh yeah.
Is that what we're doing today?
Yeah. Here's the thing about conspiracy theories though, is normally with conspiracy theories, they, you know, there's a official narrative and that's supposed to tidy up and lock everything into what it's supposed to be. But when the official narrative has so many fucking holes in it, it's like the conspiracy, is it really that? I mean, you get some shit that's like super far-fetched and out there, but This situation, this topic, this thing just invites, you know, of its own creation, so many, I'm not even going to call them, some of them are conspiracies, but alternative possibilities.
The only two things that I rule out of this was aliens weren't involved and it wasn't like another dimension. Other than that, I feel like
we're not in a Bermuda Triangle situation and we're not in a abduction situation.
No, this is the greatest mystery in like travel history.
And it's the biggest mystery in modern aviation, or probably in all of aviation.
Yeah, or just travel in general, because it's not like trains just disappear.
Yeah, and if they can't. There's fucking track. Like there's only one way fucking train can go.
Okay, yeah.
So yeah, dun dun dun. We're talking. I should have queued up the fucking X-Files theme music. So there's also a documentary out right now that's trending on Netflix. It is. We're talking the Malaysian Airlines flight. Is it MH30? What is it? 370.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, the question mark there. So is it fucking 3707? No, that's just a question mark.
I mean, if we can't find it, did it ever exist?
Yeah.
So maybe it was 370. Maybe it was just all a figment of our imaginations.
Well, no, it took off. And here's the thing. You got to be, I'm not saying careful, but you do have to kind of be somewhat responsible with this, because unlike some conspiracy theories where it was just maybe affecting a couple people, this is a conspiracy that a lot of people, you know, fell victim, not only for the victims themselves, but also for all the families that lost somebody. And this thing is, how do you lose? I understand that this was 2014, but this was after 9/11.
This is the modern age. 2014 isn't that far away from today.
No. How do you
or
fucking,
sub-decade.
How do you lose a fucking Boeing 777? Which, does that make it bigger than the 747?
Uh-huh. I think it's 747, 767, and then 777.
Okay.
But it was a an international plane. Like, it was a very large plane that held a whole lot of people. And it was a fairly new plane for its time. I want to say that it was only like 8 years into service. And I think they can usually go for like around 20 years.
If not more, I think. Yeah. I think the like seven. Oh, you're talking about just not the model, but the actual, that plane.
Yeah, the lifespan of the plane.
Of that aircraft itself. Not the model, but the actual aircraft. So whatever number that aircraft was.
So it was pretty new into service. And it had a very good record. One thing that doesn't really, it's kind of a throwaway at this point, but it was 2012. It had an accident on a runway as it was coming back in, and the right wing tip was broken off into the side of another airliner.
Okay.
And it took about 6 feet off of it. But in order for it to be flyable again, Boeing had to bring it back and they had to do work. They had to replace the entire right wing.
I would imagine that, because if
you can't just patch something on the end.
No, I mean, at 6 feet. Yeah. I mean, you look at an airplane, you're like, that fucking wing is huge. But if you're thinking, even I think, you know how they have the, I don't know what the technical term for, but how modern airplanes now almost have that sweep on the wing that goes up. They found out something that helps with stability and could everything.
Be. So if any of that's compromised.
Well, even that's almost 6 feet tall. I think that thing's fucking huge. So, but yeah, if you're taking that off, I mean, that some of that, I'm not sure the structural fucking layout of a plane wing, but I would think that like, with all of like the avionics that have to be in there, that you would need to replace quite a big section. It's like replacing, if you're trying to replace like a fender on a car, you can't just take off the dented part. It's got to be that entire piece.
Well, and the cost of the whole thing. I mean, if you didn't replace the entire wing and something went wrong, is going to be exponentially more than just fixing. What's to say that
some damage, you know, unforeseen damage, didn't happen there. I guess it's a liability thing.
But after they did that, Boeing replaced the entire wing. Everything was good.
Was it for this plane?
Yeah. Yeah,
oh, it was the model this or this plane. Exact plane?
Yep. It was this exact plane.
Oh, okay.
So it had a clean bill of health after that, though. It was fixed. It was checked. Safety, everything like that, top notch. And that was years before. I want to say it was 3 years. I'm a little fuzzy on that right now. But if it happened in 2011, it got a clean bill of health after that. Mm-hmm. It was still a fairly young plane. Sound, or as far as the plane goes, it was all sound. All and right. As it loaded up, there were 227-ish passengers. I'll say ish for later on. It was departing out of Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, which I just don't know where Malaysia is, to be honest.
So, well, I mean, you saw the maps and everything.
Yeah, I assume that, like, Malaysia was mostly Asian folks, but
yeah, so
I'm pretty sure it's more Muslim folks or Middle Eastern folks.
I'm not. Are you basing that off the name of the captain?
Both of them, yeah.
Okay. I don't know if that's the case, but I know that, so Malaysia, if you're looking at a map, so Malaysia is north of Australia. It starts connect, so it would be west of the Philippines, and it's down below, it doesn't connect to, but it's down right below Vietnam.
So kind of Cambodia, yeah, because they fly over Cambodian airspace, okay, yeah. And Vietnamese airspace.
Mm-hmm. All right, so here's the facts, and the thing is like, You know the facts of it, and the facts just kind of, they're easy to talk about, the known facts about this. And then as soon as one event occurs, that's when everything kind of is up in the air, contrary to what the official narrative is. So you have a Boeing 777. It is a Malaysian Airlines flight, number is 370, March 8th, 2014, sorry. It takes off from Kuala Lumpur, destination being Beijing, China. It's a standard red-eye flight. This flight happens all the time. I'm not sure if it's a nightly flight or anything like that, but they said it was a completely standard flight.
And there's something about less planes in the air so they can travel faster or something like that?
I would assume
that.
Because it's a red-eye, because I think it took off at like after midnight or something like that.
12:40.
So you have a collection of people. It's not all Malaysian people or Chinese people going. You have some people that are French, some people that were, I think, Australian. And so, I mean, it's an international flight. People, you know, vacations, work, things like that. So the flight itself, it is the fuel used for the trip or loaded for the trip.
That would be used for the trip.
82,000 pounds. That's fucking insane when you think, is that accurate, 82,000 pounds?
Yep, and I don't get it.
82,000 pounds that you're just like, pump this fuel in, then we're fucking like, and you just lift it. Again, this bases us off not having a strong understanding of how airplanes work. There's still some type of sorcery that goes into these things. I understand that it's, you know, aerodynamics and all that kind of shit, but
82,000 pounds of aerodynamics plus everybody on board? Come on, man.
How many tons is that? So 82 divided by...
That would be 41,000.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, 41,000 tons.
So the fuel capacity of these things is 108,000 pounds, but of course...
They sent it all the way up. They filled it all the way up to 108,000 pounds.
Okay, so the fuel used for the trip, it would take them 82,000 pounds. And they fueled it to 108,000 pounds.
And they fueled it to that 108,000 because that gives the plane enough fuel from Beijing in case they can't land there to fly to the next two closest airports.
Okay.
So it's an
It's standard. Yeah. There's nothing fishy about that. It's the standard precautions. Flight time should have been 5 hours, 37 minutes, and the fuel capacity would have allowed at the rate that the plane would be flying or was allowed to fly would allow the plane to fly for 7 hours and 31 minutes. I think, again, that's two extra hours going into the fact that you said something happened that would give them time to circle a runway if they needed just to clear something or something like that, or to get to the next airport. Yeah, the next two airports that would be capable of handling a plane that size. So plane takes off. The captain for this is Captain Zahari Ahmadsah. And his co-pilot is he's a highly tenured captain.
Yeah, he's been around for forever. He's very well respected. And I want to say it was 20 plus years maybe flying, something like that.
So his co-pilot, they considered him to be what you would consider someone green, a rookie, is 27-year-old co-pilot Farik Abdul Hamid.
Yep. And Hamid, this was actually the last flight that he had to fly as a co-pilot before
he got his captain's wings or stripes or whatever it is they promote.
So this was his last flight that he had to complete before he became
he got his own co-pilot.
Pilot, yep.
So the plane takes off, and the flight to Beijing, from the way that they stated it, some airline travel, you have to fly to like a designated waypoint, then you'll make a bearing change and maybe turn to the left or turn to the right a little bit. The way that they laid this out visually, it looked like it's a pretty straight shot. And that probably has something to do with, like you were saying, a lack of other airplanes in the air. It allows them to make a more direct route instead of kind of flying, you know, you got to fly west on this heading, then you got to kind of go north on this heading and a roundabout way. Like airplanes do that. People don't understand that it's not just a straight shot.
No, yeah. There's
different designated air lane. Yeah, air lane travel, you know, air lines of travel that airplanes are allowed to go in to stop from conflicting with other airplanes. Cause you're all flying at a similar altitude when you're flying
35,000 feet cruising altitude.
So thing takes off without incident and gets out to the border of, I guess I'll call it civilian range.
Yeah. So there's so many radars that track planes, and I had no idea until finding out about this, just how many radars and how many ways that you track planes.
It makes sense once it explains it. It's like, well, of course, Malaysia doesn't have the range to track that plane all the way to Beijing. So you would go from exiting Malaysian airspace to then into Vietnamese airspace. Mm-hmm. So air traffic control, whatever, in Vietnam would then track the plane. And then they would communicate with the plane until it left Vietnamese airspace. At which time, you know, it sounds like the captain has to be like, okay, we're leaving your airspace.
Check-ins, yeah.
Yeah, checking in, signing off, whatever. And then you enter into another airspace, you confirm with them who you are. As you exit that one, you then let them know, and then you enter into the next one. So I'm not sure if the next one would have been Chinese airspace.
It would have been Mongolian airspace.
Mongolian airspace, I think.
Or Mongolia may have been on the other side. But all those things are called handoffs. And handoffs start from the airport tower, then they move to the national tower, and then, as you said, I had no idea that you actually had national air traffic control, like, within a country. Mm-hmm. I thought it was, I guess I don't know what I thought.
Designated by that airport?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
But, which makes sense. I mean, if you're thinking about it, you're just like, oh, they're going to track us until we get close enough to the receiving airport.
Mm-hmm. And then we'll switch over at that point. Yeah. So, takeoff, 1240. It ascends to 18,000 feet. At this point, there's still a hold of the airport tower. 12:50 a.m., there's a handoff from the airport tower to the National Air Traffic Control. And something kind of cool, I think it's probably just for red eyes, but when you're signing off, you tell the air traffic control and they tell you good night.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next place that receives you, they say good morning, because you're not going to see the next or the last one till the next day.
Okay.
Whereas you're seeing these people on a new day. So there can be times in between, and they're just called blackout times. And it can be a matter of seconds between you dropping one and you picking one up.
It's like a dead zone.
Yeah.
Basically,
it's that's literally all that it is. It's you not in contact constantly with air traffic control because you have to switch your radio frequency to get to the next.
Or even their range doesn't extend that long. Yeah. There could be a time where, and I'm guessing that there's not, if you think you're flying over, because this is also flying over an area, a body of water as well. So it's not like you can just have, you know, air traffic signal towers or whatever just sitting out in the middle of the ocean. Over land, if you're flying continental United States, it makes more sense that you would always be in communication regardless
without any dead zones because
there's towers everywhere. So this thing ends up getting out of civilian national Malaysian airspace. It signs off with them and
they're at 35,000 feet. So they've already reached cruising altitude going into the next one. They say they're going to hand them off to Vietnam. Ho Chi Minh. What the radio tower was that they were getting a hold of. And this is where things just, I mean, everything was normal up to this.
So it never makes it.
Nope.
So there's never any communication. At this point, they sign off out of Malaysian airspace, and then it's never, the flight is never picked back up by Vietnamese air traffic control. And this is where everything has to be pieced together based on other entities coming in. So you have your national, civilian, all that air traffic control. You then have military controlled airspace, which probably is a little bit wider because I would assume that you would want to track inbound from a military standpoint. Your airspace or your traffic control would need to be larger because you need to have more of an awareness when possible, you know, enemies are coming into your airspace to identify those beforehand.
It's purely defensive. That's you use it obviously when you're launching planes, but you need to keep an eye on your radar screen as far out as humanly possible so you can be prepared when something's incoming that you don't know.
Yeah. So at this point, the airplane disappears. And how long is it before? I mean, it's got to be pretty quick before Vietnam or Vietnamese air traffic control is like, hey, like we're not picking up on this thing. And they try to contact the plane because it's not just like the plane radios into to Vietnamese air traffic control is like, oh, hey, by the way, we're entering your airspace. No, it's like it's a scheduled. They know what flights are supposed to be coming in.
Well, it was supposed to be 5 minutes. They say the longest time is 5 minutes. It took them 14 minutes to realize that there wasn't a connection between the two of them. So that's how minute of a span of time we're talking about. It was 14 minutes until they realized it.
So technically nine minutes. Was it 14 additional minutes outside the five or was
it
total?
It was 14 total.
So 9 minutes.
Yeah. So almost three times as long the wait that they realize something's wrong. We're not connecting to them. They start radioing again, something new. They start radioing other planes that are kind of sharing the airspace around there because I guess it's like boats, how you can like send them to check on them and then you can get a hold of them because they're close as far as microphones and stuff. They say, hey, MH370 is in the sky. We have no connection to them. Can you try calling them over the radio? Try your radio frequency, see what you can pick up from them. They radio over. They report back, nothing. We have no idea. As it was leaving the airspace of Malaysia and coming into Vietnam, it takes about a 30-degree turn to the right.
Left.
Right.
You sure?
Yep.
Oh, it does a quick, yep.
Yeah, so it takes a 30-degree turn to the right, which sends them over the South China Sea. It sends them over a strait, I think, first, but then it's into the South China Sea.
Yeah, they're, just to give some geographical reference, so that area is the Gulf of Thailand. Thailand and Malaysia are part of the same landmass. It's like the bottom portion is Malaysia, top half is Thailand. So it's kind of like you said, it's a strait between the pretty much a peninsula that comes out from Vietnam. They're aiming to fly over from Malaysia to the closest available land in Vietnam. And then, yeah, like you're talking about, I didn't see that there was that little swoop to the right.
Oh, buddy. I got this. Don't you worry.
Oh, go on.
As it takes that turn, they can see it on the radar, kind of leaving like, oh, okay, that's a little bit weird. And it definitely is odd because you're supposed to be either going straight or kind of a left-hand swoop up into China to Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
So going right over the ocean was completely not planned.
Could have been flying. I mean, if you're so used to just normal air traffic control, that could have been something almost as simple as being like, hey, we see a storm. And we see it extending way over to the west.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to bank a little bit to the right and kind of fly out around that before getting back on my scheduled course.
True. Yeah. It could be jet streams. It could be a number of things. Mm-hmm. But again, what happens in this 14 minutes is some of the most crucial shit ever. Because after they get the handoff, after they start to veer to the right, 2 minutes after the handoff, when they went black, the transponder shuts off. And a transponder is the thing that connects them to air traffic control, so they have the relay back and forth of information.
Mm-hmm.
That's to air traffic control. That gets shut off 2 minutes after the blackout period starts. Now, there's a second system.
The communication blackout.
Yeah, a communication okay. with
like radio blackout.
Air traffic control.
Gotcha.
But because we're in modern times, there's a second reporting system, and it's called ACARS. It's an acronym for aerospace... You can just kind of choose your own narrative there. But it's basically a reporting system that reports back to Boeing. So if there is an issue that they sense with like an engine or something like that, Boeing gets directly informed.
It's redundancy systems. So, it's backups. Yeah.
It's just that kind of a system to where they want to make sure. And Boeing's cutoff, the ACARS cuts off at 1:22 in the morning. So we're talking about 12:50 is the handoff from the airport tower to National. Mm-hmm. Then you have the national handoff to Vietnam. You're right around like 1:19, and this shuts off at 1:22. So this shuts off very quickly after the transponder shuts off.
Here's what I don't get, though, and this is going to fall into – there's a couple conspiracies. It's not just one. There's actually several of them. Why is there an ability in the fucking cockpit to turn off the transponder?
I don't know if it's for like resets, but they said that – they're basically told as pilots, if you touch this thing and you turn it off for no reason that we don't give you, that's not like recorded legal mm-hmm. reasons, then you're fired. Like,
yeah.
You're done. It's that important that has to be. I don't know why the shutoff is so easy. Maybe if there's an emergency, like if it catches fire or something, because it is an electronic still, or it's malfunctioning, so they have to turn it off and turn it back on with like every electronic that we have mm-hmm. in our houses. It's very weird that it has a shutoff switch to it. So that first transponder goes off 2 minutes after the blackout happens. The ACAR system gets shut off at 1:22 a.m. very shortly after that. And like you said, the Malaysian military has a longer radar system than just the airport basically does. And the Malaysian military went ahead and tracked the plane, taking a 180-degree turn back left, back towards Malaysia.
This isn't, like, real time, though. Because, like, this was after they started investigating it that all this information came out.
They saw it.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, we'll get to that. That's a very funny topic that is interesting. Okay. But they track this plane as it's turning back basically 180 degrees to go back to Malaysia. So, say you had a situation where there could have been, like,
engine problems,
you oxygen,
didn't yeah,
anything like that. You had a fire on board, which could knock out a transponder if there was an electrical fire
down in like the server. Like weirdly enough, in these planes, there's almost a room.
Yeah,
and if down below, right in the access area to it is
got to be below the cockpit because the cockpit can catch fire too.
Well, and then you also have the it doesn't have to be just the cockpit. It can be the I was going to say, they were talking about the access down to like the, essentially the nerve center of the plane, and the access hatch to it was within just the front, like a first class. So like on a plane, if you had like first class, mm-hmm. you'd have the gap between like where the bathrooms are, or the bathrooms are, I guess, what do you call that? The galley. And
could
then
be.
Like the cockpit. And there was a carpet covered door that wasn't locked. You just had to, like, you know, release a hatch.
Know where it was, basically.
Yeah, and know where it was. And then you could pop that and crawl down into essentially the nerve center or, like, wherever the server center of the plane would be. And you could access, you couldn't control the plane from there, but you could control all of the electronic aspects of like the communication, the transponder, all of that stuff.
The time frame, though, for somebody who's just like a layman who's trying to sabotage it, that timeline seems so minimal to be able to get down there and know what you're doing that you would almost have to have a very...
You'd have to know. You'd have had to have an understanding of like the operation of the like the 777 and what kind of stuff it was using.
The tricky thing about the ACORs, too, is that I believe this is the one, there's actually two. There's an ACORs monitor that's in like the, I guess, the center of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And it monitors everything as far as like heat level, oxygen levels, all that kind of stuff. But then there's the one that the pilots are at. Both of them were disabled somehow, which I don't know if it was that way or how it happened. But for both of them to be disabled, there's going to be some serious stuff that has to happen. So this is where the second thing comes in. And maybe I'm just wrong with my thoughts as far as the directions that it traveled. Because it took the 30 degree turn to the right. Then it takes a 180 degree turn back, headed towards Malaysia. The Malaysian Air Force only was able to continue tracking it for 8 more minutes.
Which is weird, because if you're looking at the flight path of it, I know it's kind of hard to follow along. If you're able to, just Google, literally just Google MH370 flight path. So Kuala Lumpur is pretty far inland, about at the farthest point on the eastern side. So you're flying all the way over the land. You then fly out over what's between the Gulf of Thailand and the South China Sea. It does the 30-degree turn you're talking about. And then the 180 sweep brings it basically back over the entire north portion of Malaysia. And it would take you more than 8 minutes just to get back to land, to get to Malaysia. Then it flies, so like talking like directional-wise on a clock, basically it flies from Kuala Lumpur and takes a 1 o'clock heading, heads towards Beijing. Then it turns about what looks like to 3 o'clock for a short period of time, and then makes a big or a small tight loop, and then starts heading at like an 8 o'clock kind of heading. And that takes it completely across the northern swath of Malaysia. So you would think
they would have to continue picking it up, right?
Well, if they can have it all the way out there into the South China Sea, you would expect that Malaysian airspace, especially for the military, would be equal distance off the western coast of Malaysia, which would take you maybe like another hour just to get to that point. The fact that they have it for 8 minutes.
They had to have known longer. And once I kind of explain what exactly happened with how the ensuing search party and everything goes, maybe it'll make a little bit more sense. But finally, the last fail-safe that they have is there's a satellite antenna that's attached, and it makes something called a handshake with the satellites.
Mm-hmm. What was that one called? That's Incom. What was it called?
I don't remember.
I'm trying to think of the company it was. Okay, keep going.
But basically what it is it's the antenna sending a signal to the satellite, and it's like a login, basically. And it's, hey, I'm here. I'm within your range. You're within my range. Nice to meet you. I'm in your space now. And it's a login for all of the internals, as far as like you can tell just by time of when you're hitting these different handshakes, basically.
Inmarsat.
Huh?
Inmarsat.
Inmarsat?
Yeah. And it's not like a satellite that's just right above Malaysia. Inmarsat is like a national company.
They're all over.
For tracking, yeah. Essentially. Yeah. And so they said that the Inmarsat satellite, here's the range on the Inmarsat satellite. This thing is way across like the Indian Ocean.
It's picked up, I think it's the Inmarsat satellite that was over Australia, wasn't it?
No, it was one that was out because, like I'll explain later, the arc that they tried to track it, that they were able to. So it's almost closer to like the peninsula where India comes out into the Indian Ocean. Okay. So this thing is able to, like you're saying, it does this, and it's very basic the way that it processes this data. Basically, it's just saying, the handshake is just like, you're still there. It's like, yep, I'm here.
Yeah, every hour on the hour.
And then it's like, you're still there. And it's like, yeah. So it can't track altitude. It can't track airspeed. And it can't track heading. But what it can track is essentially if they're able to determine that it's still reporting in, they know that it's within the range of this Inmarsat satellite. And the last primary radar contact that they have this plane, so again, it goes at like an 8 o'clock heading, comes all the way across Malaysia. And then as soon as it hits the coast of Malaysia on the west coast, it almost then goes to like a 10 o'clock heading and heads out right in between. It's called the Andaman Sea.
Okay.
That's like the little ocean area. And it, basically, it's just kind of a gulf between Indonesia and Malaysia and Thailand.
Is that the Strait of Malacca?
I think it is. Okay. And it basically, the flight path takes it to where it tries to stay equal distance between like Indonesia and Thailand. So it's almost like, had it been flying at that same course where it was going at 8 o'clock, it would have came straight across like the northern section of Indonesia, which I'm sure at that point it would have been picked up by some type of air traffic control within Indonesia. Yeah. So whatever, whoever is doing this or responsible for this, I don't know, they obviously know how to turn off all the transponders, and we're going to talk about the pilot and everything like that here in depth, but it's like the person doing this knows to try to stay as far out to sea as possible after crossing back over Malaysia. And so like the last primary radar contact that they're able, and this is again radar, this isn't the satellite contact, mm-hmm. is it gets out, I think like, 230 miles from the west coast of Malaysia. It hasn't quite passed the tip of Indonesia. And then that's where it essentially loses radar contact at, it says like 222.
Which tracks with just kind of the timeline of
everything. So an hour.
Yeah. And so the only thing that they have left is the satellite system that's collecting these handshakes. And as it's collecting the handshakes, it collects 8 more of them over the next 7 hours until 9:15 a.m. And so you're looking at roughly about 8 hours from takeoff, kind of somewhere around there, maybe.
To the last time that it has that ping?
To the last time it has a ping, it's only 7 hours, right?
Well, yeah, I think it's somewhere. That's where it gets kind of complicated. It's so weird how they calculate this data. And here's the thing is like when they're finding out this data, they have to go into and get a hold of Inmarsat, the company. I think it's a British-based company, but they have contracts all over the world. And so they have to go into this Inmarsat data because, again, it's very basic. It's like you said, it's just the, hey, you still there? Yeah, I'm still here. And they go into that, and basically out of that information, they're able to kind of extrapolate two possibilities. One of them is that it basically makes like if you have the satellite, which is way further west in, you know, over the Indian Ocean at this point, you know, think of like a radar, how it's concentric circles that go mm-hmm. out. So basically they use the ping for the Inmarsat data, and they're able to basically make like a concentric, almost like half circle or like quarter circle for the path of this one going north, but staying within the Inmarsat range. So it almost like takes it up from the last ping. And that puts it all the way up into, I think it's like Kazakhstan. And they can tell that because it's still doing this handshake, that's what the flight path could be. Well, and then the other one goes down and basically stretches in kind of a semicircle from like Indonesia and Kuala Lumpur. And it branches all the way down, kind of goes not near, but like off the west coast of Australia and like Perth, which is on the far west side, and then kind of bends back toward out into the middle of what would still be considered the Indian Ocean at that point.
Yeah. And it's, they're called arcs, and they send one out north, one out south. And I don't know if it can figure out which one is which. It's just once it gets to those arcs. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it can tell if it was a ping on the northern arc or the southern arc.
No, and how they figured it out is they basically said, okay, here's the amount of fuel, here's the flight time that it could take care of. So they did the arc and stretched that arc out going north for the however much flight time it had left at that point. So it could have been 5 hours or something. I'm not sure, out of the 7 hours and 31 minutes of fuel capacity. And that flight path ended in Kazakhstan.
Well, yeah, so you know automatically at that point that if there's no plane crash in Kazakhstan, which would be reported.
And someone would have picked it up over all that landmass.
Yeah. True.
Someone would have picked it up. And then the one going north never goes over land again. And so they
never goes over sea again, you mean?
No, it never goes over land. That arc going going south.
Oh yeah.
So it's one south, going to Kazakhstan is all over land. Yep. The one going, you know, south or so north is over Kazakhstan and all of the, you know, Asian and Indian landmass. The other one basically never touches dry land again. And the flight time ends up in just a fucking blank spot in the Indian Ocean, kind of the South Indian Ocean, I think they would consider it.
Yeah, so judging by the fuel economy that it got, it was loaded to full capacity, which can carry it 7 hours and 31 minutes. Now, when the turbines stop, they can actually kind of act as generators to continue powering the electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So there could have still been electricity as it was either gliding or dropping, anything like that, still to get these handshakes to that antenna. So after that, 9:15, it's completely lost. They have no idea. Come the next day, or I guess later that morning on June 9th, they had finally reported it after many times of telling the family and everything, the plane's just delayed, it'll be okay. They obviously knew it wasn't going to be okay.
They started pulling, I think, the families that were waiting. I mean, of course, they're going to start trying to notify people in Malaysia that they knew had next kin, but also they started notifying people because they start showing up to the airport when the plane is supposed to land.
Well, yeah, the plane is supposed to land. If it was a 5 hour and 34 minute flight, it took off right around one. They're thinking getting there 6-7 o'clock.
Yeah, whatever the time zone difference would have been. And so people that are waiting for there for the flight, they start pulling those people aside to kind of let them basically them know like, oh, hey, we lost this plane.
Which, how do you explain that to somebody? Like, who lost
a like rock, the fuck paper, you scissors? Mean you lost a plane? Like, this isn't the fucking Wright brothers. Like, there's satellites. There's all these countries that have radar. There should have been a tracking system. There's transpond. Like,
that's not your keys, man. You're not just going to lose a plane. But unfortunately, that is what happened. So, yeah, from there, it becomes a search and rescue. So search and rescue mission is launched.
They start searching first in the South China Sea.
Well, and this is where they really get some stuff fucked up, is they're searching where the
initial turn.
Yeah, right where the initial turn happened. So they're thinking it was
where the transponder turned. The transponder itself turned off, where it went off the actual radar.
So they start searching off the coast of Thailand, I think, in the South China Sea. They get some weird tips about like some oil or something like that being in the water. So they send the search party there. They check it. It was just a leak from a passing ship, something like that. It takes 2 days till March 11th for the military to come out and be like, hey, we actually saw it take a 180-degree turn the other way. We think that it's going to be back over this way towards the Strait of Malacca. We're going to make that happen. We're going to send them all the way over there. And so the second search, 2 days after, so you're talking 3 days after a crash, survival is pretty much lost at that point, I would think.
Well, here's the thing, too. This is, and I understand that, like, as far as like developed countries, okay, if you have your own airline, Kuala Lumpur is not a third world area and everything like that. Like,
it's very big.
Yeah.
Very populated.
So not only that, okay, so this is 3 years. Oh no, not 3 years, but this is post 9/11 when people are basically, if a plane is not going where it should go.
Yeah.
And the military was aware of this. Like, how does that not automatically set off alarm being like, this could have possibly been a hijacked flight. We need to get jets scrambled to find out what's going on with this flight and find out that if it's a threat and if it's a hijacking and they're looking to either kidnap all of these passengers, crash this thing into, you know, a target or something like that.
Yeah, they were headed over the ocean, which...
But as soon as it turns back and they were able to see that it's turning,
yeah,
and that they have the fact that it's coming, it starts coming back toward, like, even if they were able to determine a knot track, he said 8 minutes, the thing turns back toward Malaysia. So based on that, 8 minutes heading back toward Malaysia, how are they not like, this thing's heading back toward us where it shouldn't be heading back toward us? We're not getting any communication out of it. So at that point, it's not like they're radioing, you know, the plane's radioing to them and being like, hey, we're having an emergency. We need someplace to land. It's just dead air.
Yeah, so at that point, it's not hunting airports. It's on a path that is strictly out of the way of those places.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a major failing to not send some, and I don't know what the Malaysian Air Force looks like, but they have to have jets or something, fighter jets that can go up there something. At least to 35,000 feet and check on this plane to see if everything's hunky-dory. Mm-hmm. And that's, this whole thing just gets so weird, and it kind of makes sense after learning about why it happens, but after they send out the second search party in the Strait of Malacca, the very next day, March 12th, the military comes out with another revelation about the turn toward that last little turn that you were talking mm-hmm. about towards the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
So then they're like, yeah, we actually continued to pick them up on radar as they headed out towards the Indian Ocean. And basically the reason that they gave, which it makes a lot of sense in a way, but they didn't want other countries to know how far out their radar stretched. Which is fairly common for people to not let them know, like, how far out.
Then handle it yourself. Like,
yeah, which they did, you know, in turn ask for help. But the military didn't want to give away their secret of how good a radar system they had, just in case, which I'm assuming being that close to China mm-hmm. and that close to Russia and everything, probably good to have some aces up your sleeve and not let them know how good your technology is.
Yeah.
But it just defies logic to think that they had to hold back two times to not say, well, we saw them this way. And that's what makes me think that their radar is actually a lot better than it was because they lied about it twice.
Yeah.
I think there's a chance that they might have watched it a lot longer because they pointed them towards the Indian Ocean. The third search area was a fairly large area. They had asked for help initially from Australia. Australia was more than willing to help. They actually, I think they fronted, like, the first little bit of funding that was needed for the search parties.
Well, once they got to the end of the position where they counted out the northern route that would have taken them through those Inmarsat pings into Kazakhstan, at that point, you can just fly over land on that path and be like, do we see crash? Do we see any type of wreckage? It's going to be on, even if it's up in the mountains or something like that.
You'll hear from a village, yo, this plane flew over way too low.
Or someone calling in from someplace being like, hey, we saw some fire or we saw something like that. You're going to get something that comes up. So I'm not sure of the timeline, but they were able to pretty much cancel out and say, hey, it didn't take off. You know, it didn't take the northern course that would have gone over. And it would have even gone over Chinese airspace too. So like, it's not like China doesn't have the ability if they're tracking this thing, which they definitely would have, to scramble some jets up there to find out what the fuck's going on. So through that process of elimination, they're like, okay, well, unfortunately now we have to go with the southern route. And because the search area where they determined where the fuel would have run out and everything along that mm-hmm. Inmarsat ping, that circular kind of flight path, what must have happened is after they lost initial radar contact, the military, it must have either got past Indonesia and then it pretty much just took another hard left and started going down that direction. So the search field was kind of like a little bit south, not south of Australia as in the form of like, if you take Australia, you look down south from that, but you have to go like out way west of Australia out into the, Indian Ocean, and then a little bit south. And the search field was insane. And so because
there's two of them, the first one that they ran onto, 118,000 square miles. Mm-hmm. That's a huge swath of ocean that they're covering. And not to mention, not to say that this would play a factor, but it was something that I learned at a young age. The Indian Ocean is like the worst ocean as far as like issues and wind blowing.
I think that's why you always hear of like the tsunamis and shit is because it's like
the most treacherous ocean that there is.
And so Australia kind of takes the lead because they're like, well, we're the closest to this. And Australia said that it was focusing its search in a 0.6 million square kilometer area, which when you see it, it's a huge chunk of the ocean when, if you were to be trying to look at that amount. But when you're actually looking at it from, you know, a map of the ocean, it's not a speck, but I mean, it's like, how would you even search all that?
It's basically like covering your eyes and throwing a dart at a dartboard. You have no idea. And that's why this first shot that they took was this 118,000 square miles.
It's a huge, was it the largest search in?
I would assume it's probably the largest. Maybe the Titanic could have been, because it was 72 years that they searched for it. It could have been bigger in that way.
I actually had this conversation a little bit earlier today. So the whole thing with the Titanic, though, is because of where, was it the Olympia that came in? Mm-hmm. Because of where the Olympia rescued survivors.
Or not the Olympia, it was another one, because the Olympia was the one that was still.
That's right. It was, I can't remember the name of the one that California, rescued them. But like because it was able to rescue the survivors in that area, they knew technically within a pretty reasonable area where the Titanic was. That whole thing was only limited, and they didn't find it was because of the technology of the day.
Okay.
They had to have the sonar, and then obviously you couldn't positively identify it until you had the sub technology capable of reaching the depths
to get
that
down
low.
To it to,
so I mean, okay. By you know, the stretch of like ease, the Titanic was a fucking cakewalk in location compared to this, despite the fact that there's more than 100 years of advancement.
Well, yeah, and this is like literally the beginnings of it, because that Inmarsat, is that what the satellite company was? I guess Australia or somebody else got a hold of them. They talked to them. They reran the numbers, and they decided that the next search point that they had was going to be 680 miles north. So maybe they had looked at the calculations and couldn't quite figure it out. They searched a very similar sized location up there.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it had to do with essentially when they started factoring in, because again, it couldn't track airspeed, elevation, anything like that. I think they had to make alterations to it based upon if the plane would have been flying faster or slower. It extends the range by at least
that's
a few
true,
hundred
it's
miles.
Burning up less fuel.
Yeah, it's burning up less fuel and everything. So they determine, and what the official narrative is that this thing went down in the South Indian Ocean. So that's where they start focusing. And despite a massive search by, you know, it's multiple countries trying to participate through ships with sonar. 26 countries. Ships that are trying to search this. Airplanes that are doing aerial coverage looking for a debris field, which, you know, if a plane goes down, here's the thing. Despite what Captain Phillips is the goddamn Tom Hanks one where I'm the captain now. What's the one? Sully.
Nope. Sully. Oh, yeah, Sully Sullenberger, the guy that landed on the
lands Hudson. On the Hudson. So the deal is people watch that and they're like, oh, so these things can like land on water and float.
Yeah.
It's not like that. So essentially, I mean, obviously it can happen like that because that actually happened.
That also happened because their altitude wasn't high enough. This was 30,000 or 35,000 feet. I don't think Sully ever got up that high.
No. And the fact is once that plane runs out of fuel, you're in, I don't know if you want to control, you're in either a stall or some type of dive.
You're a glider. You're a hang glider at that point.
And guess what? This thing, you know, obviously doesn't have fuel at this point, so you're lacking that 108,000 pounds of fuel. Mm-hmm. But the trajectory of something when you can't control it, when the engines are shut down and you're trying to, and that's even if someone was in control at this point. When it hits the water, I mean, you've seen if something hits the water from a high enough, it's like hitting concrete.
Yeah.
So whether it hits and does, you know, tries to hit it and tries to level out or anything like that, they even said that, and we're going to get into the debris here in a second, which, you know, happens over the course of a long period of time. They were saying if the plane went in more vertically, it would cause less of a debris field, less damage.
Well, yeah, because it's like when you see a high diver or something like that, if they go straight in, their splash is going to be a lot shorter or a lot smaller.
And the thing, too, is a plane, it's made of metal. It's not like a ship where the whole structural design is to displace water and keep the thing afloat. If a plane goes in at that point, it's going down.
Yeah,
and it's sinking. It's not like the, and all it has to do is to, you know, have that air escape the cabin itself to keep it from being pressurized. Sure, if it's a pressurized tube with air forced to stay in it, it might float. It might have some buoyancy. If that thing depressurizes at all, guess what? Water can just seep in there, weight the thing down, and it's sinking.
Yeah, as soon as that counterweight meets its maker, then it's going to sink to the bottom.
And like you were saying, like the way that the ocean is here, not only are you dealing with like really rough seas and everything, but the layout of the ocean floor, it's like a fucking mountain range with these insane canyons and stuff like that. The depth and the topography, it makes trying to detect something on the bottom, especially the size of an airplane, which, you know, all of us are like, an airplane is fucking huge. Well, guess what? Compared to the ocean, no, it's fucking not.
Speck of sand.
So trying to locate this thing is crazy. At this point, full disclosure, they've never located the actual wreckage of this thing or where it went down.
No. Now, the only kind of oddly cool thing that came out of this was they were able to map, I think it was like 3 million miles of ocean that they hadn't ever mapped before. So that was how much the search was they were mapping the topography of everything underwater with submarines and shit like that. And then just different parts of the world that we've never even explored that are out there. So we're going to try to find a plane in an area that we mapped that never had even been explored. That's just insane to me.
So I'm not sure if it would be oceanographers or who would be that would be tracking this, but eventually there are, as part of this search, you know, they're looking for anything and everything they can to confirm if this is what occurred, if the plane crashed. That's, you know, the official narrative. I believe that is what happened, is that the plane did actually crash. The conspiracy is, how did this whole thing happen and why does it happen? But
oh, no. No, there's plenty of conspiracies where it didn't crash.
I'm saying what I believe.
Okay.
I'm not saying that that's what really
intentional
happened.
Intentional or accidental?
Oh, not accidental. Not okay. Accidental.
Okay.
They mapped out what debris could have, you know, they don't know what debris could have been possible. What they did is they tried to map out the currents to state, here's what the currents would do, and here's the expected time frame of what would, you know, you think it, like Australia is, it's the closest part to this, that if the wreckage is going to go anywhere, it's going to go toward Australia. Completely wrong.
Yeah, the way you're dealing with tides and different everything else, it's going to push things different directions, wind storms,
it hurricanes. Was actually similarly almost this, like, a lot of different directions, all going toward the west. And so they actually showed what would be a estimation of time frame it would take any type of debris to get anywhere. And everything would be traveling west across the largest expanse of water instead of going to the east, which would be closer to Australia. And so through mapping this out, they determined that if it was going to wash up anywhere, it was going to be somewhere within the region of like Madagascar. So all the way to fucking Africa.
Yeah, I don't really know the distances quite well.
2,500 miles.
2,800 miles to Madagascar?
Around 25. Okay, so it was actually 2,500 miles to where they found the first piece.
Okay. So you would have to think, just since everything is round, even though Madagascar is so far away, it's probably the closer landmass to anything
in which
else.
The way the tides were going, yes.
So the tides would be coming in that way, which is very interesting that all this is known, because conspiracy brain is going to kick in with some of that stuff. But basically, after they gave it a good year, they called it off May of 2015, said, we're not going to find anything. We did everything that we could. We involved 26 countries. I think they spent like $160 million, which seems like it should just be a drop in the bucket for something as coordinated as this was.
Mm-hmm. They're like, airline.
Huh?
A major airline with financial backing from, you know, probably the country. And
the country,
countries.
Because the country owned it.
And multiple other countries. It's not like all these other countries are like sending Malaysia a bill. They're probably searching for this because they also probably had people that were on the flight.
Well, they did in 2018. There was this cool-ass company. It's Texas-based, and it's called Ocean Infinity.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually came over and went pro bono and said, if we find something, we'll send you the bill. Malaysia's like, if you don't find anything, it's coming out of your pocket. And they went over and did the expansive search, and it's kind of, they have a like a mothership, and then they have underwater drones that look like torpedoes, and they use the mothership to basically chart the ocean floor, and then they send the submersible drones down there to look for everything. They ended up coming up with nothing, but that was a situation where they said they were going to do it for free. I'm sure they probably paid a decent amount of the $160 million as far as like labor for the other countries and all that.
So I guess backtrack from where that was in 2018, but fast forward to where they actually call off the search. July 29th, 2015, so more than a year after this occurs, on St. Andre or Union Island, who's the guy that found it?
it's a French controlled island. The guy that found it, I think.
Colonialism.
Odd that the French would have a small colony island off of Africa.
French India. It wasn't that who took over was, or no, British were the ones that were in India.
I think they were both fighting and jockeying for areas.
Because that's when you had like French Indochina and stuff. Okay, yeah. You know what? Colonialism knows no bounds.
No, so it's way down there. But on this day, one of the right wing flapperons from flight 370 washes ashore. They see something white on the beach. They don't know what it is. They go get it. It's a big, vast expanse. It's about 6 feet long. I think they said maybe 5 feet long. But, just a very odd occurrence. So they call it in. They bring it in. They go ahead and check the serial number. Boom. Serial number matches MH370. So that we'll get to there.
Okay.
But that's the first piece of debris that's found.
Here's the thing, too, is what's fucking crazy about this is the flapperon, it was found by a local guy, Johnny B, with the E, with the little fancy French thing above it, G-E-U, Bayou, I don't know, more than a year after. So it ends up washing up on the beach of this. This is a tiny fucking island, man.
Yeah, very, very small. So the chances of it hitting there seem so astronomically high.
Here's what I don't get either. So the flapperon, which, again, we discussed this. This sounds like the most made up fucking, just like, it's just like you're looking for, like, you've named everything else on the plane. And then there's this one piece. Essentially, the piece was like a middle section where, you know, you have the area between the fuselage going out in the wing. It's like a straight portion.
Uh-huh.
And then you have the part of the wing that starts kind of sweeping back. There was the area right between where it sweeps back, that angled area. The flapperon apparently was right there.
It can either lift or it can fall in order to speed up.
That's just lazy naming. They were trying to figure out a name for it. They're like, it's the flapperon. Fuck it. Write it down.
I have a constant high thought all the time about why stuff's named the way that it is. Because who looked at a grape and was like, I'm going to call you a grape. You have no thought or axis of reason as to why you would do that.
Well, when you look back on it, it's like everything goes back to like some type of like Latin, and it's like Latin the translation was, and then it's some lovely terminology for it, but we've just like bastardized it down to like just the most simple, like grape.
Yeah.
Or French, like, oh, grape.
What the fuck, though? Were the Latin people doing the same thing? Like, you had to come up with a name for it, so you're just looking at it like, what's that piece? Well, we'll call it a flapperon.
Mm-hmm.
So, right flapperon found July 29th, 2015. How's it
float? This thing is metal. It's not airtight. The fuck is this thing floating?
It was just a piece of it. So it wasn't the entire flapperon. It was a straight metal piece that went over the top of it.
Well, I'm looking at the picture right now,
It's an actual...
No, look at this shit. That's the fucking flapperon.
Yeah, but it was just a flat piece.
I know it is. What I'm saying, though, so this is a... Okay, it looks like a mini wing, a small portion of the wing. It's got a rounded edge on the front, and then the back tapers down to more of a point. But what I'm saying is that it's also got a hole in it. So is it just that it had enough air inside to stay buoyant? Like, take a piece of metal that's not, like, made into, a boat shape, like water disbursement, like, type shape. Like, how the fuck does this thing float?
If it's aluminum will float.
Oh, that's true.
So it's... And this will come into play because this is a very big piece of the puzzle for one of the conspiracy theories. June 2016, we're going to go directional on this, a right wing flap. So we found a right flapperon and then a right wing flap.
A year later.
Also found on Pemba Island, which is another island off of Madagascar. Then May 2016 of the same year before that, there was a right wing fragment that was found in Mauritius. So we have a right flapperon, a right wing flap, and then a right wing fragment. And all three of these had serial numbers on them miraculously that matched 370. So there's been other pieces that have been found and kind of put together as far as like, yes, this is a piece, but it's been spread out kind of everywhere. So there's no really conclusive as to where it is still because it was just so random where they would find these pieces of wreckage. But these three pieces had propped it up as to, yes, this is definitely where it went down over here.
And they weren't the only three, though, right? There were other pieces found that they were able to
tie back based on, like, there was another piece that said, like, no step on it. And that might have actually been the fragment of one of the wings. They said it was coming from the flaps. There was, like, I want to say it was the border of one of the windows or something like that that had something else. And then at one point, there was a, like, cowling or, like, area from one of the engines that had a partial
Rolls-Royce on it.
Rolls-Royce yep. symbol on it, which was the manufacturer of the engine that the Boeing 777 used.
Yeah, so they are finding more stuff, but these first three finds are kind of very interesting, and we'll talk about interesting with these conspiracy theories right now, because it's just, there's no real answer that we have. We have best guesses, and then we have a million conspiracy theories that kind of fall in and out of the best guess. And unfortunately, in this situation, some of this stuff is going to sound really crazy, but it's technically not really a conspiracy because we don't have a definitive answer.
Yeah, it's only a conspiracy if it goes counter to what the actual proven thing would be.
Yeah. And that's all you need to know. We're in conspiracy theory time.
Man, this thing really doesn't kick. I forgot I haven't seen this show in long enough. I thought the...
I don't think you're getting it.
Good God, man.
There you go.
There we go.
So, first conspiracy theory, and this one I find, like, this really gets my nips hard. Either Malaysia or another foreign power spread this initial debris. And the reason that I can say that is because it was all right-wing debris. And as we talked about right in the beginning, this wasn't... The Malaysian Flight 370 did not have one right wing. It had two right wings. Because the initial first wing that was pulled off, that was replaced,
mm-hmm.
was still kept in a boneyard that they believe was in Australia. It wasn't ever destroyed because all these pieces from these very expensive airplanes were all basically put in a boneyard. So it's basically like a junk pile for...
I didn't see any of this, so you're blowing my fucking mind.
Really?
Right now. No, oh, I didn't. Dude. Yeah,
we're about cover to get this. Real weird real quick.
Okay.
So it is possible, and it has potential to say that Malaysia was looking for a way to make it sound like they had actually figured out sort of where it all came from.
So that would make sense as well, because they would share similar, or, you know, not the same serial number, because it's a different part. Exact
same serial number.
Would it?
Yep, because it was all the same pieces to the same plane, so a serial number would have to be attached to every single one of them.
Okay.
So everything would be matching with the same serial number. And because this wing was already in use for years, there's going to be air wear and there's going to be time where the paint is going to be a little bit more faded. It's going to be closer to a match than a fresh new wing.
Well, yeah, it's also been sitting like what you, especially because it's been floating in water and everything like that, you can make an educated, it's like, you know, when they do carbon dating on stuff, you can make a guess based on certain things about the age of it or, you know, the wear and tear or where it was acquired from. Kind of same thing. But when something's been floating in the water for over a year, I'm doing quotes here. What's your argument to say, like, well, this thing seems like it was sitting out in the rain for a while or sitting out in a boneyard, and then it was put in the, like, what's to say the difference between being weather worn in the ocean, like, that you couldn't fabricate that, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is really going to blow your mind if you haven't heard about this. There was barnacle growth on all four sides of this flapperon that they found.
Okay, you're going to have to explain what the theory behind that is. I understand the whole concept of barnacles being in the ocean, stuff like that, but when you say all four sides, what does that indicate?
So it indicates that it would have had to have been submerged underwater. Now, when they tested it and they put it in water a second time to kind of figure out floating patterns and how it move, it floated. So there was a side that was always up in the air that didn't have water on it that couldn't have grown barnacles. These barnacles, as well. You
could have flipped in the waves.
It could have, but it would be dry on one side.
Okay.
Pretty much for most of the time. The other interesting thing about the barnacles is the barnacle species that they found on these was not native to that part of the Indian Ocean. The barnacles that they found that were on it are actually native to a colder part of the Indian Ocean that wouldn't have survived in the warmer waters on the trip to
Yeah, over the course of a year. It's not like it's just being submerged in water, you know, warmer water in the Indian Ocean for a few days or even a few weeks. I mean, once it enters that path to get closer to Madagascar and St. Andre, Reunion Island, it's there for at least, what, a couple months on its way getting into
those warmer. It's going to get warmer. Those barnacles are going to die off in the heat. So it was found with a barnacle that's not native to the area where it was found. Barnacles were on all four sides of them, yet it floated. So the attachment, as far as barnacles having to stay underwater or else they dry out, they're going to fall off on something if it floats, because there's always going to be a side exposed to air.
Yeah.
And all three of these main pieces that they first connected to the flight all had the same serial number, but they were all right-wing pieces, which they had unlimited access to right-wing pieces. So if you're looking to set up a frame job, I'm not saying that this would be easy, because you would have to get into the boneyard and steal these. Mm-hmm. And they've never gone back and actually said, yeah, no, this is like, we're missing these parts from the wing that are in the boneyard. Like, that's never been confirmed.
Yeah.
So it possible, impossible. That's sort of for you to decide. I just find it very intriguing to think that somebody would go to these lengths to try to cover up one of the biggest air mysteries, the biggest air mystery that's ever happened in the history of the world. So that to me seems very interesting. Along with that, there were six more pieces of wreckage that were found in Madagascar on one of the coasts. And Malaysia says, hey, you hold on to them. You turn them over directly to us. They sent a, I don't know what you would call them, like an ambassador kind of.
Except I believe liaison.
Yeah, from Malaysia down to the capital of Madagascar where these are being held. On his way to pick up these six pieces, he was assassinated. His rental car was just in a barrage of bullets that killed him. Now, that seems really weird that this guy would fly to Madagascar from Malaysia without really anybody but the two governments knowing, and then all of a sudden he just gets assassinated down there. Like, I don't know what the murder rate is in Madagascar, but I got to imagine it's a little bit higher than the likelihood.
It's weirdly coincidental.
Yeah, which, again, this could all just be a weird coincidence. That shit happens. He could have been driving a sick rental car. He could have driven in the wrong part of town. Some shit happened. It just seems very odd. And ever since then, basically, Malaysia and Madagascar haven't really made their communications about these things public. So, could be something very weird there. I don't know what it would be as far as, like, maybe a country or something that has maybe some ulterior motives to do it. Those are two of the conspiracies. The one that I think you and I are both kind of in agreement on is going to be pilot sabotage.
Yeah, so let's pivot a little bit and talk about that.
Can we take a leak first?
Huh?
Can we pee first?
Who went pee first?
Can we pee first?
Oh, can we pee first? Yeah, we can pee first. All right, we'll be right back. All right, while we take a break from class and take care of some business, you can also take care of some business.
If you don't follow us on Instagram or Twitter already, our Instagram handle is historicallyhighpod. That's historicallyhighpod. And our Twitter is historicallyhigh. That's historicallyhi.
All right, and back to our show. All right, we're back at it. Okay, so pivoting to the pilot. So here's my thing. I think that this is the most feasible conspiracy. And the reason that this is a conspiracy is that the official narrative is that the pilot didn't, it wasn't pilot error, and that he wasn't the cause of it, which I don't know how you come up with this when a plane doesn't make deviations like this, even on fucking autopilot or some shit. And so just kind of going back again, Captain Zahari Ahmad Shah, I'm just going to say Captain Shah.
Yeah.
So Captain Shah, exemplary record with Malaysian Airlines and throughout his flight career. One of the things that kind of lends credence for me to believe that it was pilot error and it was premeditated, it would be essentially considered, if it was premeditated, it would be suicide, mass murder.
So, yeah, just so we can be clear, this is a little less conspiracy theory and more towards what the experts believe happened.
Correct.
So this wasn't the official narrative, but this is kind of like people in the aerospace industry.
Correct, but it makes it a conspiracy theory because it's not the official story. True. And because they have exonerated and said this wasn't, they've come out directly and said
this wasn't what happened.
Hands down, though, I mean, this only makes sense.
Yes.
Out of everything, this only makes sense to me.
Transponders and everything turn off. That is in control of the pilot from the cockpit. The Inmarsat is not able to be turned off. So that would explain why the Inmarsat was still active. Now, here's why I believe that this occurred. So you have this guy. I'm not saying there's any information. Of course, if there was any type of foul play found, it would make a lot of sense for both Malaysian Airlines, which you said was acquired by the Malaysian government after all this. I don't know if it's a bailout or if they just took over controlling interest of it. For them to say that we have a pilot that has a stellar record, all of our, you know, evaluations that our pilots are required to go through have shown no instances essentially of instability or anything like that. If that's their narrative, and then they were to say, well, yeah, this is the case, then you're like, well, then what prevents this from happening from any other pilot? Why?
You are trying to kind of relax the general public.
You're limiting damage.
Yeah. And Zahari was, I think, for most of his career, an exemplary guy. He gave back, he donated food to his villages, did all that. He was fairly well off, I think. He had a wife and two children. Something kind of odd. They said kind of the 6 weeks leading up to what happened on March 8th, they said that he kind of become more withdrawn. He was more sullen. He wanted to hang out by himself. One of the things that he did by himself was he actually had a full-blown...
he had a flight simulator.
Yeah, 777 flight simulator.
It was through Microsoft Flight Simulator, but he had it set up. I believe they showed his home setup, and it was like, you know, three screens.
It was
a legit setup. So, of course, when something like this happens, everybody, both crew of the aircraft and also all the passengers, it you know, has a massive investigation. Basically, what they're looking for, of course, anybody that was on the plane that shouldn't have been on the plane, making sure everybody's identities are who they say they were, trying to count out any type of, you know, terrorism, hijacking, all that kind of stuff. So, of course, being in control of the plane, there's going to be a lot of focus on the captain. Well, when they were doing their investigation, they seized his hard drives and the flight simulator, and they sent it to the FBI. I don't know. I'm sure there's a reason for that. I'm just trying to figure out if they're trying to keep everything close to the chest in-house, why they're sending this to the FBI. Maybe they didn't have the ability to go through and investigate all of the information within the hard drives, deleted information. What they found, and this came out in a leak 2 years later, is there was deleted flight paths that were very similar to the flight path that they believe this plane took, where the plane went out into the South China Sea. Plane made a left, flew out over into the Indian Ocean a little bit, and then made a shot down into the area west of Australia. They found these as deleted flight logs and flights that this guy had played on the flight simulator.
Very recently, too. Not like he had done it 6 years ago, five years ago. It was very recent. And not only that, the flights that they had downloaded to see, it almost felt like it was more of a test to see how far the fuel capacity would carry him.
Where he could get.
Yeah. So it wasn't like to a destination in India or Africa or Australia.
It was this flight path. What all the other
similar. It wasn't the exact
flight path. No, not the exact one, of course. But it was similar enough to where within... The directions and the bearings were very close within, you know, certain degrees. It's not like if you were to say, well, he didn't make a left here, make a right here. So basically, he made the same type of movements that he made earlier on the flight path, flying out over into that dark zone, took a left, went out into the Indian Ocean. And then from there, I think the bearing that they determined on the flight simulator, and this had all been deleted too. They had to go in and like recreate and find this.
Yeah. So he was... trying to leave them with a tidbit of what happened.
Well, if you're deleting it, I don't think.
Or, huh?
If you're deleting it, I don't think you are leaving a tidbit.
Why would you make it that obvious?
Like, why wouldn't you just leave it active? You just leave it with your saved flight plans.
I would consider it probably for the same reason why he did it in the first place. I mean, he was obviously looking for a shock. There's a million ways to kill yourself.
That's true.
So it basically followed very similar flight path, flying out into the middle of, you know, the South Indian Ocean. He wasn't like, it was like, he could have made it. I mean, it wasn't like he flew a flight path to Perth, which he could have made. That, mm-hmm. you know, that flight path could have been moved over a little bit more to the east and he could have flew to Perth. So it wasn't like, hey, I'm just trying to see if this thing can get to Perth. So they find this information, and despite this, they still say that it wasn't what it like it appears to be, where it was you know, suicide and mass murder.
They also found out that he had a little platonic side piece as Did well he? And that was what kind of had him withdrawn from his family. His family moved out like 3 days before this happened. So his family left their house and left him alone days before this flight met its demise. So whether it was him not thinking that was going to happen and then fell into a deep depression after they left, I don't know where the flight logs that were deleted correspond with him being alone at that point, but there could have been some manic choices maybe being made at the time.
Well, if that had been something that he had rehearsed prior and just had, you know, some thoughts about it, or even just some, you know, hypotheticals of like, what if I just did this? But then all you need, all of a sudden you have a psychological push that makes you think your life isn't going in the direction that it's going. And that's why I think that this is the most, you know, credible, likely scenario in this situation, is that you have, you know, despite of his accomplishments, and I'm not saying, you know, I'm not saying that he was a scumbag or anything like that previous in his life, but what I'm saying is that there is obvious, you know, what am I trying to say here? There's obvious planning that this is something that he had rehearsed before. So why is that not just become the official narrative? Like, what is, I understand what you're trying to avoid, the fact that saying like, yeah, we can't properly vet these people, or we can't predict what anybody is going to be going through, and all of a sudden on a whim they just decide like, this is the time, this is the flight. Here's what had to have happened, or would have had to have happened for this to occur. So he's got his co-pilot. I don't think that this guy, you know, co-pilot Hamid, is going to hear this guy and be like, hey, what do you think, we just take this thing down? I don't see that guy being like, okay. So kind of,
you don't think the guy that was about to get his full piloting shit was like, hey, why don't we just end this all right now?
I'm
in.
So what it would have taken, and again, I keep saying this, you know, post 9/11 everything, just remember that post 9/11, as soon as you're in that cockpit, that thing is a fucking fortress.
Yeah, you're locked in, you're in Fort Knox.
So what it would take, you know, you have a tenured pilot flying with his co-pilot. Hey man, you mind hopping in the back and grab me a drink, grab me a bottle of water, something like that. All it would take is him leaving the cockpit, going in the back, that guy stepping away from the controls, flip it to autopilot, do whatever, and just locking it with no way for that co-pilot to then get back in.
And being none the wiser of the situation, because this probably happens all the time.
Exactly. Like, how many times do you pop out of your seat, or, you know, or if you call someone up and be like, hey, can you grab us? Like, it could have been any of those scenarios. You might not even think twice about it.
Yeah. Hey, this other transponder back there is being finicky. Will you go check it to make sure it's
It could have been
online?
Anything like that. And so he gets locked out. Here's where I start to wonder about this. Okay. I understand that this would have had to have happened prior to him making this turn. Because as soon as he makes this turn and he looks at the pilot, he's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Why did you flip off the transponder? Why did you shut down the communications for the plane? That right there is going to have him either try to take control from the pilot, radio to someone on the ground, hey, this guy's going rogue, or whatever you want the technical term of it. So he obviously has to get him out. Now, I didn't know this at the time, but control of the pressurization of the cabin, they have something in the cockpit that allows them to depressurize the cabin.
Yeah, in case of a fire or they're flying too low, anything like that.
Yeah.
So,
and here's the other thing. So when those oxygen masks, I don't like talking about this because it sets the reality in for you and everything. So the whole point is when the cabin depressurizes, the oxygen masks come down, You put that on, there's about 15 to 20 minutes of oxygen. It's not a finite amount of oxygen.
Finite resource that yes. you have.
The whole point of that being is that when the cabin depressurizes and you have these oxygen masks on, the standard procedure is to bring the plane then down to an elevation in which the cabin does not need to be pressurized, where there's breathable air. And the cabin itself can then, the oxygen in the cabin without the mask can sustain the passengers inside. Well, if you stay at 35,000 feet, oh, and also the masks within the cockpit, they're made to last a lot longer.
Yeah, well, it's like a... probably like a Maverick type face mask for them. Like something that they just strap on.
It's like the big rubberized one that has, instead of just the little, you know, cup that goes with the little bag that hangs on the front. It looks like a fighter, and then it goes around the back of your head. So when he gets the co-pilot to go back, all he has to do after it's locked is simply depressurize the cabin, throw his mask on. I'm not sure what the time frame for his mask would be or anything like that. Again, once the plane...
This is all just conjecture, too. This isn't... We're not trying to say that this is what happened. I do love where you're going, because I think I'm right along here, too. Mm-hmm. This is just a...
It's conspiracy talk.
Yeah, what's that... Like a personal opinion recreation.
There you go. So, guy goes back, locks the door. He throws that on, depressurizes the cabin. When he depressurizes that, guess what? Co-pilot's back there as well. What I'm trying to figure out here is that... As soon as that happens, no one on the plane decides to pull out their cell phone and start trying to text or call. They have you turn off your phone on a plane into airplane mode because they say, and I probably believe this because I don't understand the technical goings on about a fucking airplane and the way it communicates with the ground, but I would assume if there's a lot of incoming signals or outgoing signals, it might fuck with some stuff.
Well, yeah, and you hear about there were, I think, cell phone calls made in the planes that were involved in 9/11.
Yes. So you have this happening. This would have all had to happen in the time frame before the plane either starts making its moves or as soon as he locks that guy out and starts making his own moves, it starts taking place within the plane being deviated off of its course. Obviously, the co-pilot is like, what the fuck? Like, this isn't right. Like, I can feel it's turning. We're not supposed to be turning. What's going on? You would think that he would be like, somebody get their phone out. I don't know if there's any type of communication or radio system within the back half of the plane for any of the flight staff or flight crew to communicate in case something happens and there's communication lost within the cockpit. But
can I fill in some gaps?
Yeah.
My thoughts. Right before that last handoff, before the black period, he says what he says to the co-pilot, you know, something's not right, something's going on, go check.
Mm-hmm.
Sends him out, locks him out, good night, black period. He reaches up, he pulls out the entire fuse system because the fuse system sits right up above the pilot. So in case there is a fire, you can pull the circuit breaker. So that way you can stop what's feeding the fire and try to put it out. He's the only one that can do that. So as soon as he pulls that circuit breaker, turns it to the right, it shuts off all the comm and everything in the airplane. And not only that, he makes that turn. If you're headed that way for 2 or 3 minutes over the ocean, you're going to run out of towers for any cell phones to be picked up. So I think that is part of the issue, or part of the thing that he pulled was when he took that turn over the ocean, it was to get them away from being able to make a cell phone call to someone on land because there's no tower to be able to pick that call up.
Yeah, I can.
That's just what I think.
No. I can understand that. Obviously, if this is the scenario that happened, it had to be well thought out. He rehearsed this kind of stuff. Flight simulator isn't going to tell you when you're not detectable by radar, but being a pilot of, you know, however many odd years.
You've flown over plenty of places to know.
Definitely. Especially if you're making this flight all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know the time frame that it takes you to get picked back up by the next tower, you know, so forth. What I'm curious about is, let's say that you do have just the 15 minutes of air that you have. So you're still over the ocean at that point. Maybe that's why he turns to the right to kill some time before he has to turn back to the left. But at the same time, people are, you know, I don't know if the co-pilot's not trying to cause a panic or anything like that. But at that point, maybe he's like, oh, is there something wrong with the plane? Are we turning back to our land? Are we going to land or anything like that? He's maybe trying to get in. He sees the oxygen mask drop down. I don't know if he tries to throw one on or whatnot. But you would think that if that happened, the first thing that you always hear about when you hear about planes going down or planes having difficulties is people pull out their phones and try to text their loved ones or make a call, hey, this isn't going well, you know, I love you and all that kind of stuff. If someone does that, has their phone off airplane mode, you got to assume at least multiple people are trying to go ahead and text or call or anything like that. I would assume their phones are still trying to cycle through to where then when they do fly over areas, because again, he had to fly back over that entire section of Malaysia, something would have sent through to somebody. Even if everybody is either passed out or dead from lack of oxygen in the back, there still should be an outgoing signal. I wouldn't assume the killing communications with the plane. It's not like, you know, it's jamming the signal or anything like that. It's just there's no place for the signal to go. So once you fly back over that area, I would assume something would pick up some type of signal or something like that.
Yeah, there's a chance that something may still be pending to be sent.
And get through to someone's family or something like that. You know, here nor there. So what I believe happened is then he takes it out, gets further out over the Indian Ocean, going back the other direction, and then following along the flight plan or similar to what he practiced, the plane just ends up going that direction. They can't tell again the altitude. Who knows if he brings the thing back down to a lower altitude to where he doesn't then run out of oxygen that the pilots are able to use, and then just rides the thing on its course until it runs out of fuel, and then he just dives it into the ocean.
If he depressurizes, rises up to 40,000 feet to cut the oxygen by 5,000 feet even more to try to bleed them out quicker, what's the... it's not asphyxiation.
Epoxiation. Epoxy or something like that.
Yeah, epoxiation, whatever it's called. If he's up there, he runs those people out of that oxygen up there, they're dead. He's able to bring it back down to 30,000, 35,000. If he can repressurize the cabin, then he's just smooth sailing.
Exactly. Or even at that point, because he might know that, and at that point, maybe he doesn't even know that, you know, about the Inmarsat or anything like that. But at that point, like, what's there to stop him?
Yeah, he's free and clear.
It's not a situation where it's like, what was the, I can't remember the flight number that was heading toward, not the one that crashed in the Pentagon, the one that crashed in Pennsylvania, where the passengers actually got and took it down. He's basically eliminating the possibility about anyone breaching the cockpit to then try to take control of the plane. And he knows at that point, regardless if they're able to scramble military jets to try to intercept the plane, what he's the only one alive. What do they intercept? They're not intercepting anything. Like they can't, they shoot it down and then all of a sudden it's the same result of all of the passengers dying. But it's the most likely scenario. Like what's the explanation for why the plane deviates course? They're like, well, there was epoxia even before this. And then the autopilot malfunctioned and took them on this course or anything like that. Like, I think the autopilot has to be a predetermined thing where you're telling it where to fly. So you would still then have to program where you wanted the autopilot to take you, which still means that it would have had to put in, you know, someone would have had to put that information in.
The autopilot would make more gradual turns as well.
It wouldn't care about staying over the ocean.
Uh-huh.
It would just then take you, like, you're not flying out so far over Indonesia that you then have to stay, you know, it would take the most.
It would try to either bring it back on course or head back to the course it was just on.
Mm-hmm. But the fact that the narrative is that there's no pilot error in this situation, like, I really don't understand that. I don't understand how someone can make that call when it's, you have so much evidence, not just the flight simulator, not just the recovered flight path from the fucking rehearsal runs or anything like that. But what's worse, saying that like this plane can fly itself and just flies out into the middle of the ocean and kills everybody, or saying that, because what are you going to trust more? Like, okay, well, this pilot is no longer, you know, living. This, you know, this guy's dead. He's not able to do this anymore. Or yeah, the planes just do this sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, epoxia seems like it would explain everything, because if Shaw was asleep too when it all happened and he maybe lost control, autopilot didn't take over, you could say it that way, but everything was too intentional. Like the movements that were made mm-hmm. couldn't be made just by a plane losing it. And I want to say it was Payne Stewart. You remember the old golfer?
Yeah.
So he died in a plane crash and it was a private plane and it was epoxia that killed everybody. They ended up flying like another 4,000 miles before the plane went down mm-hmm. with everybody dead. Like, so it's there's some thought behind it that it could have happened that way, but like I say, everything was too deliberate to lead to where it would have
been. The plane starts going the complete opposite direction.
Yeah. I mean, it only seems intentional, and I don't know the country of Malaysia. I assume the people are all very good people. I also think that there's a chance, much like we see with Asian leadership, and or not Asian leadership, but countries in Asia's leadership, mm-hmm.
That sphere of influence, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, they tend to not always give the entirety of the story, or they don't really have to make sense when they give a conclusion, because clearly this doesn't make sense.
No. And I think this is the most likely scenario, and just the fact that it's discounted and not, you know, they've come out and, you know, they've come out and said, no, this isn't what happened. Then give us what the fuck happened.
I think once everybody was dead on the plane from loss of oxygen, he turned it around. He charted a course for wherever he was going to go. And I think he enjoyed the last 5 hours of his life doing what he loved.
If he was even able to stay alive that long, if he brought it down, was able to repressurize. Well, because I'm wondering, you have to be able to repressurize that cabin and use the ox. Because what I'm saying is, like, you know, the whole reason that the cabin is able to go and maintain pressurization is because there's a supply of oxygen that plane has that mm-hmm. allows you to do that. If the oxygen for emergency situations is then utilizing all of that oxygen to keep people alive for that 15 minutes in which you're supposed to be bringing the plane down to an elevation where...
You don't think there's some way to convert oxygen up there or to enrich it to be able to blow it into the cabin?
I don't know.
I don't think every plane would have a set amount of oxygen, because what if you got a bunch of mouth breathers on there? Like, you can't emergency land because you're out of air.
Well, no. What I'm saying, though, is I think that there's probably a set amount, but that amount, if you're utilizing it in a way where you're having to then repressurize, because how much oxygen does it take to repressurize? I don't know. Again, we're just like, this is all conjecture because we don't have experience.
Yeah, we're not pilots.
But the whole thing is the plane makes too many deviations to make any type of sense. And the thing that doesn't make sense to me is then how is nobody, I understand that, like, you don't get a cell signal when you're in a plane or anything like that. But at the same time, once the plane, you know, if it gets to a lower level and it can pick up a signal or something happen, I don't know. The other thing that I find really odd about this is I get with the whole, it goes back to the debris. Is it saying that, you know, I get the fact that maybe, you know, bodies were never found or anything like that. I'm like, okay, well, here's the really shitty fact about nature is that if those bodies are floating in the ocean for that long and it takes more than a year for a piece of metal to work its way floating that way, means the bodies are probably floating that way. And there's a lot of things in the ocean that are going to go ahead and take the free food.
Oh, I think they're all still down in the fuselage.
I was thinking about that too, is that if the fuselage essentially didn't break apart enough to allow anything to escape, filled with water, depressurized, didn't float, then it's just sitting down there like a tomb.
Yeah, and all those people are still whole people because the temperature and everything like that doesn't allow decomposition to happen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't think they're the only people that are down there at the bottom of the ocean that are still pretty intact, but it just... It's the only way that you can bring any logic to it. And unfortunately, it's a very dark outcome, but it seems like that's really the only logical conclusion, was that this was all due to Shaw. I'm sure he's a great guy. Don't know what was going on at the time, but he made some real bad decisions and he took 227-ish people with him. And we can kind of cruise through the other conspiracies because I think that's kind of where we're
landed. Let's go from most likely and then kind of branch off to like more of the far-fetched stuff. Just like a lot of TV shows, we're going to pull a Hunting Hitler. And if you've already watched the Netflix documentary, you'll kind of find that that's what they do toward the tail end of it as you start to get the more far-fetched stuff. Some of the stuff has little connections that you can make. It's the Charlie Kelly thing off of fucking the mailroom thing.
Pepe Silva.
Pepe Silvia. You got all the fucking pieces of yarn stretching out and everything like that. So what do you want to talk about for the second one?
Just because we led with the two, actually the third, because the first one was the rest of the pieces from the mm-hmm. right wing.
Touching back on that one, I'm curious to kind of know your opinion on what do you think was, okay, what do you think the cause of that? And why would they then plant
that?
If it's Malaysia, I'm saying it is because it gives them more of an accurate, like, hey, we were searching in the right areas.
You think it closes it? You think it closes it? Helps them close it, tidy it up with a bow and saying, plane crashed, we have the debris. Yeah, sorry, end of story.
We know for sure that there's debris, there had to have been a crash. There wasn't anything else that was up. It wasn't, our plane didn't get hijacked. It didn't, anything else didn't happen. It just got crashed.
Okay.
As far as a foreign player, this is going to lead into more of the conspiracy theories. There are certain other countries that could have played a hand in maybe cyber hijacking, something like that. And the plane was landed at maybe an airport, an Air Force base, a black site, something where they were able to hide the plane and the plane had something on it. There were, again, this is just pure speculation, but these people really were on there. There were about 20 people that were a part of a company who I think they did like semiconductors, something like that. But they worked with NSA in America and kind of helped build.
Inmarsat has a huge contract with the U.S. government too.
Yeah. So there's a chance that maybe these 20 guys were assets. There's something at play there. We'll get into a very odd discrepancy in the cargo weight. But the next one's just a real easy one, cut and dry, but still very odd. There were 227 people officially on the plane. There were 228 plane tickets scanned, and there was an extra, I don't know how big it converts with kilos, but there was like an extra 89 kilos.
I think that, I always say with kilos, the easy way to do it is just like you double it or something like that.
Okay, so 89 kilos could be the size of a human.
Oh, yeah, definitely. 89 kilos, double that, that's 190, 200 pounds.
Yeah, so it was added to
my figures are, I know, sorry, my figures are still off, but it's the size of a human.
Yeah, we're American. We don't know this metric system bullshit. It's better than everything that we have. But it was odd that they had officially said it was 227, but they had scanned 228 tickets. Why would you scan an extra ticket? And then why would there be extra weight added to the cargo list?
There were also two passports that didn't match up to two of the people. Now there's talk about those people being political refugees.
Yeah, they were both Iranian citizens that had used fake passports. One was from Australia, and I think one was from like Germany.
Something like that.
Yeah, they were either that or they were trying to fly to Germany, but automatically your ears perk up, unfortunately, when you hear
they came into Malaysia with their real passports, flew out of Malaysia using the fake passports
because they were able to contact I think family, something like that, in order to get that information. But regardless, it's very unlikely that two people that were seeking refugee status in a foreign country were going to try to bring the plane down that was going to take them to a better life and freedom.
Yeah.
So don't know who this 228th passenger was. It seems like there was somebody else on there. Was it a player that maybe helped facilitate as far as working with an outside entity to bring the plane down? Could it have been somebody that Shaw knew? Who really knows? Just kind of interesting that their official report was 227, but somehow there were more tickets scanned and there was extra weight on the plane.
One of the more far-fetched ones was that possibly the two people that had the fake passports had knowledge of essentially the kind of the operating systems for the 777. This is getting into really, really tinfoil hat territory, but here it goes. Their seat positions were located in first class within a few rows of the hatch to get down into the data center for the plane. Now, you can't operate the plane with that data center or anything like that. What you can do, like I said earlier, is you can shut off all the communications that were shut off in this scenario. Can't shut off the Inmarsat. One of them creates a distraction, pulls the, not the flight crew, but essentially the crew that's manning the cabin and everything, gets their attention. The other person sneaks into the front, pops that hatch real quick, crawls down in there, closes it behind him, and uses some type of either laptop or, you know, some type of hacking device, closes down that communication. Once that goes down in the cockpit, if the pilots have knowledge that part of that is, if something goes wrong in the cockpit, they didn't turn it off or anything like that, I'm not sure what the training would be if they're like, hey, go down and maybe try to reset. This is like unplug it and plug it back in for 10 seconds type shit. Again, tinfoil hattie. But going down and the pilot being like, hey, telling his co-pilot, same type of thing. Can you either stay up here while I go check on that, or will you go check on that? See if something happened, maybe go reset it. We need to establish communication. During that time, what if he loses communication and he turns and he's like, we're going to head back to Kuala Lumpur and land this thing, because now we can't communicate with anybody going forward. How are we going to get permission to land? How are we going to do anything like that? We're going to go and turn around. Well, that requires that guy to leave the cockpit. At that point, what's to stop the second person from essentially forcing himself rushing the cockpit with an open door, waiting for that, and then taking control of the plane? Now you're like, okay, well then why fly the fucking plane out into the middle of the ocean? Again, this gets crazy. The invasion of Crimea had occurred 4 months prior to this, and every bit of media attention on worldwide news was about the invasion of Crimea, and all of the focus was on that. If all of a sudden a passenger liner goes down, it's a giant mystery as why it happens. You lose 228-ish people. That's then going to go ahead and pull some pressure from national news, especially when you have so many countries invested in looking into something like this.
Oh, yeah.
It's not to say that, yeah, it's a suicide mission, everything like that, but we've seen a lot of shit that shows that Russia doesn't care about sending people in to die.
No, not
just
at all.
Blindly. So,
and I think Russia and Iran are probably pretty close.
I'm pretty sure they're pretty fucking close. But not in from a geographical sense,
there's plenty of diplomatic communication.
Yes, definitely. So that could have been something to try to pull eyes off of that.
And just getting into kind of what we talked about.
Well, what happens 4 months after this?
Yeah, bad. This was maybe the worst year for any airliner in the world.
For air disasters, I think. There was one in which two of them collided on a runway. This isn't this event and the one we're just going to touch on here in a second aren't the highest casualties for an airline disaster. It was the two highest for airliners that were in flight. Mm-hmm. There was another one that took place. I'm not sure of the timing on it. It was years before, in which two planes collided on a runway, one taking off, one landing, and destroyed each other on the runway.
So nuts.
I don't even get how that fucking happens. No. Like, you can see, I understand, like, you. How many times have you, I'm,
pull up.
I'm movies here, but yes, you just fuck, you've seen them increase the throttle, pull the plane back up when it's on approach. I believe that's a possibility. I believe that has some basis in reality. But 4 months later, what was the Malaysian flight?
MH17
gets hit by a surface-to-air missile over Ukraine.
Yep.
Over Ukraine, and kills everybody on board. Who took responsibility for that?
That's still kind of up in the air. There's been fingers pointed towards Russia, but there's never really been any confirmation, but it's probably more likely than not Russia.
So what's not to say, again, I'm not a crazy person. We're not crazy here. We're just having fun talking about shit, but what's not to say that 4 months after this happens, this starts not getting as much media attention as it should, and all of a sudden something else happens, and now all the media attention is focused back on Malaysian Airlines. Like, what the fuck is going on over there?
Well, and just to push your crazy level one more time, what if it wasn't Russia that did it? What if there was a conspiracy that after 9/11... America required all 777 planes to have a Honeywell monitor in it to where it can be remotely flown to stop hijackers from being able to take it over.
Would that be a worldwide requirement, though? Because if you're not allowing flights, I'm not sure, I don't know Malaysian Airlines' fucking flight schedule or where all they fly. It's a huge international airline, obviously, because it's going from Malaysia to China. But who's to say that they required any type of Boeing, United States made airplanes to have this to prevent any type of flights being hijacked that could then be used against
yeah,
any of our us or our allies or anything like that.
So that's where I'm getting into, because this is like the juiciest one that I found, and it's just like, this doesn't make any sense, but it's so cool to think about. So Boeing is an American company, and after 9/11, Honeywell got together with Boeing. This is actually something that is real.
Honeywell, like the thermostat.
Yep.
At Coke.
They handle all sorts of electronics and shit like that.
But yeah, it's like GE.
Yeah.
Most notably known for that. You're telling me that GE designs the fucking washing machine in your house, but they also design fucking airline engines. They also design the fucking the gun on the front of an A-10 Warthog and everything like that. It's like you have a consumer understanding of what this company might make, but you know, companies that are this big have literally can have their hands in anything and everything.
Large scale, it's incredible. So they actually did get together with Honeywell after 9/11, and they developed I don't know, because again, none of this is official, so that's what makes it even bigger of a conspiracy theory, that they installed these autopilot remote driving features to airplanes after 9/11, after they went through and I'm sure beta tested them and all that. The fact that Boeing's an American company, they could have put them in all of the Boeing 777s. It makes sense. You'd want that in an international airplane, but it's also an American built airplane. So there's a chance. There could have been a chance. And again, I keep saying this because it's a conspiracy.
I'm not saying I believe it, but we've covered a lot of like shady government shit on this podcast already up to this point, with different government programs, different things that the government has done that are supposed to be, you know, black ops and things like that. That if that was public information, do you know how like terrifying that would be? Yeah. Like, look at the fucking self-driving shit on a fucking Tesla and what's happened in situations with that. You're going to say that. Yeah, I mean, there's this thing that we have in planes that it can completely override if someone is able to have access to it. The ability for the airline captain to control, and then we can just do whatever with the flight. If you don't believe that that's possible, I'm not saying likely, but look at the fact that we can fly a drone halfway across the world by someone sitting in fucking Palo Alto, California or something, sitting in front of a computer screen flying a drone. Like,
it's lawn chair and flip-flops flying a drone halfway across.
It's not
the world.
A huge leap to say, like, well, how does that technology not just translate over to a bigger plane?
Yeah. Yeah, you're telling me there's a chance, and I do believe that that is what it is. And then we start to get a little crazier, and I start to think there's no possible way. But in tying in to the Flight 17 that was shot down with the rocket, so the working theory behind this conspiracy is that America took over 370, flew it to a place called Diego Garcia Military Island, which is down in the Indian Ocean. It's an island that's only inhabited by American service people. The conspiracy is that, Diego Garcia Military, I don't know if it's an island or a reserve, but it's got a runway.
Mm-hmm.
Conspiracy theory goes that the plane was actually landed in Diego Garcia, and the people were either all imprisoned, or if they had died from the hypoxia from being in the air, they were taken care of and gotten rid of. Then the American government may have repainted on the side of 370, crossed out the zero, cleaned up the three a little bit, and it was Flight 17. Then flew it over Ukraine as Flight 17, but nobody was on it, or the people that had already died from 370 were on it still. And then America shot it down over Ukraine to try to bring a little bit more...
Try to tie everything full circle.
Yeah, try to bring more look to what was going on in Crimea and in Ukraine at that point.
Okay.
That's a fucking crazy thing that I just said.
I'll try to crazy one up, yeah.
Okay.
So this also relates to that. So apparently at the same time, and this is going to play into this. So when they were first doing the search in the South China Sea for this, there was a company within the United States, I think, I can't remember the name of it. Watch the documentary, it brings it up. A couple of the people that actually took part in it talk at length. Not saying that they're credible or anything like that. I'm just, again, we're in crazy fucking do territory right now. At the time that this all happened, there were some military training exercises going on within the region that the United States was taking part in. these people that were helping out with this search, how they were helping out with, not the military, but how these civilians were helping out with the search over in the States, is they were being provided as up-to-date satellite imagery of the South China Sea as they could, and these people would be assigned basically a quadrant to be reviewing as closely as they possibly could. There was a woman that had believed that she had identified essentially a large debris field that, and it was very soon after, because they were taking images as soon as it happened and everything, that identified a debris field in the South China Sea that would have been concurrent with the type of debris field left by a plane of this size, something like this, going down in that area. It wasn't looked into or anything like that as far as her looking into it. She tried to pass on the information, but there was no official investigation into it that really came to light. Part of this plays into, and I think you had mentioned something about cargo a little bit. Yeah. And so there were, I don't know if anyone's ever seen the, like the wrapped cargo containers that they put on airplanes. Basically, they just, they kind of are square, but they have kind of a concave that shapes the same shape of the plane that it's able to move into the plane and then like slide in into,
slide into place.
Exactly. So there were four of these pretty large containers. I mean, these things aren't small. They're about the size of, I don't know, like a fucking Yugo or like a Geo Metro. They're pretty decent sized. And the manifest had them listed as like lithium batteries, walkie-talkies, and a couple other seemingly innocuous like electronic devices and everything. The thing about these four containers is after these four containers were actually packaged, they weren't checked by the airport within the normal manner. They were essentially sealed up at the facility outside the airport and then brought to the plane and loaded onto this plane.
So there was no understanding of what was inside of
them. Not just what they said that was inside them. One of the super out there conspiracies is that this could have possibly been some type of illegally acquired or stolen technology that had been acquired from the United States or from United States allies that was being flown to Beijing to China for them to go ahead and essentially reverse engineer to garner or to gather this technology.
Yeah.
And once it was found out about what happened and the way that they tie it in, it doesn't make sense, but you can it has enough connectivity that you can be like, okay, we can talk. It's why we can talk about this.
Yeah. So before you get into it, this is my last one too, kind of weaved in. The specifics towards the cargo load was that it was supposed to have 5,400 pounds worth of lithium ion batteries inside the cargo hold. 5,400 pounds of lithium ion batteries. Do you understand the kind of explosion that that would make? Like how stupid it would be to carry that much lithium ion in the same place? So that was what came out and it was leaked. Malaysia came back and said, there was sort of a mix up on the whole cargo list of what it actually was. The manifest,
whatever they call it.
Yeah, the manifest. They said that it was only 221 pounds of batteries, and the remaining 5,000 in change were chargers and other accessories, which, to me, why would you have 2.5 tons of chargers and accessories for only 221?
Well, why was it wrong in the first place?
Yeah.
If you're admitting that it's wrong, then what's to not state that all of it was wrong?
It blows my mind to
think. You don't know? Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't originally what it was labeled, then, like, what is it? Oh, well, it was that, but then it was also this other stuff. Like,
It's extremely convenient to be able to say that it was something different, and just, like, going along with the official story that Malaysia released, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, here's the other thing, too. You're still admitting that it was lithium. So, like, regardless if it was that many pounds or just, like, some pounds less, it's still an explosive thing that you're transporting through the air. And I understand that that's probably natural. You send that stuff through the air. I think there's been circumstances where there's actually, like, some type of, like, airline accident with, like, a cargo transport, like, some lithium. And that's how they tied it back to this, is because that caused a disaster in some other way during, like, an airline flight. It wasn't, like, it was a cargo plane. It wasn't a passenger plane.
But in this situation, what's 5,000 pounds of chargers and accessories flying into a communist country that's not friends with the United States? Mm-hmm. Is there a chance that this was some, like you say, secret technology that they were trying to reverse engineer? Was it a
You're already
weapon?
Having to change the story.
Yeah. Was it a weapon, something that they were smuggling in? Mm-hmm. It wasn't uranium, obviously, because I think that would probably lead to some more shit. But it could have been a plethora of anything. And the fact that they had to go through and, like, try to clean that story up seems very suspicious, which I'm sure you're going to...
So one of the other things that goes to explain the loss of communication with the airplane is that in that area, which would make sense when they're doing military exercises, is they said they spoke to somebody who was vetted. The journalist that was talking said they were a vetted individual, that they were, you know, within the U.S. Air Force and they had experience with this type of stuff. That's not to say it couldn't have been the guy that fucking like drives the gas truck up to refuel the plane or something like that. It was just something to the fact that this was a person that they said had familiarity. Again, I'm not leading any type of credibility to this. I'm just saying what I'm repeating the information that I was given. But they said that in that area, due to the training exercises, there were several United States, they call them AWACS. And if you've ever watched any type of action movie or anything like that within the 90s or even currently, it's the airplane that looks like it has a giant flying saucer on top of it. It's got like a little stand and then it has this big disc on top of it and it rotates. The job of the AWAC is it provides essentially almost like a mobile satellite. And so it can actually view anything, I want to say below it.
Yeah.
So it can fly over and it can create a huge swath of radar, like a portable radar.
Probably what the disc on top is facing down.
Yep. The other thing about that too is these AWACS also have the ability to jam communications and radar. And so the another far-fetched conspiracy is that the time that the United States found out essentially that there was a possibility that this plane was carrying this cargo that they didn't want, making it to its destination, they intercepted the flight with these AWACS. I want to say that the way they stated it is one was flying above it, one was flying below it to make sure that all communications were essentially jammed from above and below. That they communicated or were able to communicate with the pilot telling them that they needed to divert the plane, fly back, do something that was contrary to what he was told, and that the pilot either didn't comply with it or something occurred in which then they had to fire on the airplane. They had, you know, fighter jets or whatever, fire on the airplane, and that's what essentially resulted in the debris field in the South China Sea, was that the plane was actually blown up, crash landed, and that's what occurred. Now, kind of, I guess, part of the you know, there's a lot of holes in that fucking theory and a lot you have to like try to fucking suspend disbelief, you know, suspend your belief for.
There are some parts of it that feel good though. Like it's not all out of the ordinary. Like there's still some parts of it where it's like there could be some kernels of something.
That's
what makes
it. That's why we're talking about it. If it was just completely batshit crazy, which it kind of is, but at the same time, if there's enough evidence or capability to do this kind of stuff, then it's worth having, you know, a talk about. But what that, you know, what the argument against that is then all of the debris would have washed up on Malaysia, Thailand, on the other side, Vietnam. You would have had all this debris that then proved that this is where it crash landed.
You can't go around and collect all that debris to try to cover up that.
Well, okay. No. I understand what you're saying by that. And I completely understand that. Something could have, you know, slipped by or something like that. I'm not arguing for this. We're using our fucking like tinfoil hats, motherships beaming down signals, and we're, you know, talking about some ideas here. My thought on the whole matter is if you already have we have fleets throughout the entire world at all times. That's why we, you know, when people are talking about coming out of the Navy, you don't just hear people talking about like, I was stationed here and we never left here. You travel the world.
Yeah.
So
that's part of the experience.
Exactly. So if you have essentially a fleet of planes that are able to be in a position, or sorry, not a fleet of planes, of a fleet of ships that are able to be in a position where you're able to find and identify where this plane goes down, which if a fighter jet is shooting it down or something like that, you're going to know where it goes down. You'll be able to follow the plane down. You'll be able to see, have essentially all of the wreckage that you can at that time gathered up. You've seen, you know, where like they try to raise boats up and all that kind of stuff to gather it, or even when they're able to locate like an airline disaster, you know, resurface it and then they bring it back and they study it. Like
on the darker side of things, that's how people catch whales.
There you go. So what I'm saying is that, you know, some stuff might slip through as far as fragments of wreckage and everything like that, they might wash up on different shores. But when they're washing up on the shore of Thailand, of Malaysia, possibly Vietnam, within that kind of enclosed Gulf area, what's not to say that if America has a military presence and is able to be running military operations in that area, that they're not able to keep anything found that slips through their, you know, salvage efforts or anything like that, that they couldn't have got all of this stuff. And then if they have access to the stuff in which they salvaged, what's not to say, going along with your, you know, our tinfoil hatty theory about essentially the pieces that were found,
the evidence being planted,
what's not to say that stuff then can't, you know, fit the narrative of washing up on other someplace else that then fits the narrative of saying, oh no, this is where the plane went. And again, this is all tying it into fucking crazy batshit stuff. And Marsat having a, and it's not a private thing, knowing that they have a contract with the U.S. government. You go to Inmarsat's website, they showed, you can go down and you can see contractors, United States government. What's not to say they talk to Inmarsat and is like, hey, we're paying you a shitload of money, right? You want us to keep using you guys? Fantastic. Okay, what we're going to go ahead and do is you're just going to go ahead and take the data that you said you had to compile and reconstruct and just maybe say that the pilot took this thing out to an area where, you know, likelihood of finding this plane is, you know, next to zero.
Yeah, Neil, you know where there's areas that have been unfound, unchecked, undiscovered. So just say that it dropped off over there.
Mm-hmm. And again, we're going in order, or not so much in order, but we discussed what was the most likely scenario, pilot error in this situation, one person taking upon themselves to do this horrible act. What I'm also saying is that I believe that. I don't believe what we're talking about, but what I'm saying is that if you're, the official narrative doesn't make sense, it's interesting to look at all of the possibilities. How many, you know, we've just recently seen within the last couple of days of one of our drones getting intercepted and shot down, not shot down or forced down. I don't know what exactly occurred there.
They sprayed fuel on it.
They did. And then they like destroyed the propeller on it or something like that. What I'm saying is that we have situations where things can be brought down in a situation where it's a controlled environment and then, you know, cleaned up. And it, I understand with, you know, the tides and everything, it took over a year, 2,500 miles for this stuff to wash up on these beaches and everything. But when you're finding just the pieces, and the majority of the pieces are from this right wing, that there happened to have been just a spare right wing that had been previously damaged, washed up somewhere, it doesn't make it believable, but it makes it discussable, I guess.
And that's sort of the brilliance of this and why it just has always kind of had my mind in a pretzel from day one, is if it was all just normal, if there was 227 passengers and 227 tickets, if all that lined up, you wouldn't be able to have that theory. If it had the 5,400 pounds of lithium batteries on it, that's weird, but it also opens up the door when you come back and say, well, actually, it opens up another theory. As far as the cyber hijacking and Honeywell shit, that's like they built in more of that than you could see. But looking at spreading the wing debris, the fact that there's a chance that that is what was going on, like, it all just leaves enough to be like, huh, this could be something different. We don't know what this is.
When you don't provide explanation to how something happens, when you're just like, we lost the plane. We don't know really what happened. We just know this is maybe where it went down. And look, now we have some pieces that support exactly what we say happened. You got to be like, you got to fill in some gaps for us. This is what makes people's minds go to these fucking places.
And just like we started off talking, and just like you said, this wasn't an isolated incident where the only victims were the ones on the plane. There's a groundswell of people that are supporters, that are family members of these people that died, that are still questioning the official story that seems like bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going to try to search for an answer. And then you have other people that are getting involved that think that they have it all figured out. Did amount of like amateur sleuths and amateur aviation specialists and people that tried to research this and look into it. I mean, it was so wide and so vast and expansive, the amount of people that did it. Everybody's going to bring something to the table. And as we know, whenever there's a lot of people drawn into a situation. There's going to be a few of them that take artistic liberty and get creative with stuff.
When you bring in that many individuals with different thought processes, you're going to come to a lot of different conclusions. Now, true, a lot of these conclusions can be, you know, thought up or drummed up by select individuals, one or two people having these theories and everything. But if there's supporting or possibilities behind it, they're going to gain a little bit of traction. The other thing, too, is it doesn't romanticize it, but it makes it more interesting. Of course, it's like disaster porn and everything. Mm-hmm. Like, why wouldn't people be, you know, more interested if it was something nefarious and it wasn't just what they came out with? Had they just come out and said, you know, all facts and all the evidence leads to the pilot doing this, guess what? Had they just come out and said that, no one would have any type of information, or no one would even be having these other discussions, and it would kill any other argument for possible, you know, other conclusions.
Yeah, I think there would absolutely be still be conspiracy theories, because I think it's kind of like what we talked about before the pod, I think last night, but there is still enough mysticism about what's going on that there can be conjecture, because even though they say that's what the official report is, mm-hmm. that's still a completely foreign planet that's flying above the Earth that we have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
When we try to figure out, you know, did these people all die of hypoxia? That's just conjecture. We yeah. have no idea what mm-hmm. the fuck happened. Could the 228th person that was on the plane that they said wasn't on the plane have had a gun and just wiped everybody out? Absolutely possible. Is that possible because the plane kept flying? Probably not. The co-pilot situation, you know, you would have to, we had to make that leap to figure out how to get the co-pilot out of the cockpit mm-hmm. as opposed to Shaw killing him somehow, poisoning him, something like that. Like, there's even saying that Shaw did what he did, you would still have to then figure out how to construct the narrative. And that's where the people that live in Conspiracy Alley really reside.
Yeah. When you don't provide answers, people come up with their own answers.
Yeah. So even if they had said this was pilot error, this guy did this, it was a suicide mission, you still have to piece together everything else, because if you can't, or if you know that everybody knows that you don't know, then that's where conspiracy theories come into play.
And here's the thing, too. Me believing that that's the most likely situation that occurred is that it was the pilot. My understanding, you know, the logical part of my brain just thinks, okay, so you can either just provide no explanation and leave this up in the air for people to try to come up with their own theories on it, or you can pin it on one person who there's a lot of evidence pointing to how it would be, especially considering he rehearsed this and all that kind of stuff. But instead of just going down the chain of logic and saying, this connects to this, this connects to this, and then just saying, no, it wasn't one person, this wasn't the fault of one person, then you're saying, so, like, who the fuck was it the fault of?
Yeah.
Then it leads yeah. you to being the fault of anybody and everybody. So, I mean, if there's a lesson to be learned here, it's just like, if it walks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, if it fucking looks like a duck, it's a fucking duck. Just fucking say it's a duck. Don't be like, well, we understand that it kind of looks like a duck, but through our findings, we've determined that's not a duck. It's like, what else is it then?
Yeah. It's like I told you, this is an Occam's razor. The only way that you can explain it, an Occam's razor, is basically whatever seems to be the most likely and logical option is just the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the most likely answer to this is the only way it could have happened was Zahari Ahmad Shaw, the captain of the plane, was the reason that it went down.
Yeah, he was just, here's the thing too, is if history has shown us anything, it's that humans are exactly that. They're humans. And
we're all fallible.
We're all fallible. And all it takes is for the fallible person to be in a position where they have responsibility and the ability to hurt other people. Who's the dude that ran Midnight Climax? Oh, God, what the fuck was his name? J. Edgar was the top guy in the FBI.
Yeah,
and then, I can't remember. Go back and listen to that episode anyway. But what I'm saying is that all it takes is for one person with a set of skills and knowledge, with a situation in which they don't have oversight, to do something fucking crazy, and you run into situations like this. And, you know, it's, thank God nothing like this has happened since then. I'm sure precautions and technology has advanced in ways that now we can track planes all over the world, and I'm sure that a lot of good has come out of this tragedy and everything. But what also should be learned about this is,
just fucking provide the information and fucking make it logical. And when something's staring you in the face that can easily wrap up the situation, maybe just fucking go with that.
Yeah. Yeah. You can explain the human element of this situation because you get it. And if anything else can be learned from this, just be nice to everybody because you don't know what that person's going through and how their response to whatever they're going through could affect everybody else. Be careful with people that have
flight simulators in their home.
Yeah, always be suspicious of anybody that likes to fly planes. Wary of
someone with a flight simulator and access to an airplane. It might be practice, but it might be practice for the wrong thing. All right, man. You got anything else on this?
No, it's going to take me probably a week or more of listening to more stuff and watching more documentaries to really continue to get this out of my system. This is why I had to let go of it when it happened, because there's a logical explanation, but there's a million different
options. It's a big rabbit hole, man.
Yep.
Like Alice in Wonderland. Yep. All right, guys. Well, thanks again for joining us this week, and we'll be back with you next week.
All right. Peace.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for another episode. If you like what you heard, hit that subscribe and like button. Follow us. If you didn't like what you heard, still hit that anyway, because we'll probably cover something in the future that you do like. Please follow us on our social media. Adam, hit them with it.
Our Instagram is historicallyhighpod, historicallyhighpod, and we are on Twitter at historicallyhigh, that's historicallyhi.
All right. And if you guys want to send in any feedback, suggestions, hit us up on those two, or you can even do it on Gmail. It's historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.
Peace.